This episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Mixtape Massacre, the ultimate horror board game. Mixtape Massacre is a tabletop board game where up to six players play as horror film archetypes and compete in a fictional 1986 killing spree to be remembered. With tons of references to all of your favorite 1980s music and pop culture, Mixtape Massacre will have you laughing while you're slashing. After being sold out for a second time, Mixtape Massacre is back in stock in its third printing. The Shockwaves team loves this game, and it is guaranteed to be a good time for you the next game night. The Shockwaves team loves this game, and it is guaranteed to be a good time for your next game night. To purchase, visit mixtapemassacre.com and have a killer good time. Want more? The Black Mask expansion pack will arrive this May, adding more cards, slashes, victims, and gameplay to the mix. Again, visit mixtapemassacre.com.
Tonight's episode is also brought to you by Fright Rags. Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. New this week at Fright Rags, they have the amazing new basket case collection. They also have a new Masters of Horror line, which includes officially licensed merchandise from horror icons like Alfred Hitchcock, Lon Chaney, Bela Lugosi, and more. Fright Rags also have new merchandise collections available for both Pinhead and Dawn of the Dead. So go over to www.fright-rags.com now. You can enter the code SHOCK0118 at checkout to get 10% off your entire order. Again, that's SHOCK0118. Head over to www.fright-rags.com.
In just a few weeks, the Shockwaves team is heading to Texas Frightmare, and we hope to see all of you there. Texas Frightmare is the Southwest's premier horror convention, and it's now celebrating its 13th year. They always have the best guests, the best panels, and you don't want to miss it. This year's guests include Clive Barker, several of the Cenobites, including Doug Bradley, all the kids from It's Losers Club, Tobin Bell, Shawnee Smith, Ron Perlman, Charlie Band, Brad Dourif, Katie Featherstone, and more. Plus, the Shockwaves team will be moderating all the fantastic panels, and we will have a live Shockwave show plus horror trivia. Head to www.texasfrightmareweekend.com and get your tickets now. Elric really wants you to come touch his face.
All right, everybody, welcome to the live episode of Shockwaves here at the Chattanooga Film Festival. Hi, everybody. A lot of familiar faces, a lot of new faces, but in case you don't know who the hell we are the Shockwaves podcast. I'm Rob Galuzzo.
I am Rebecca McKendry.
I'm Eric Kane.
He's a little more sober.
This is
now
how we do it. You usually introduce me. This
I
is throwing me off.
You. I'm no. sorry. I'm already throwing
5 years
off.
Of doing this.
We're thrown off already.
So there's three of the four of us. Ryan Turek is our fourth host. He's back in Los Angeles. But we're going to do our best to present a live version of the show. We've got a lot of guests, including a very special one at the end of the show is going to be Joe Bob Briggs.
Yeah.
It's kind of amazing.
Yeah.
We always wanted him on the show. We're going to talk weird movies with
him. Our topic is the weirdest movies we have ever seen.
Oh, ever?
Ever.
I just went for weird.
Oh, no. I went with
from
like...
this week is what
I went
picked.
From the weirdest shit I have ever watched in my entire life.
Yes. Well,
these are deep cuts.
For Becca,
off,
that's going to be deep.
Yeah.
Thank you to the festival's great, by the way. This is our first time here. Thank you, Chris. Chris Bull.
Yes, Chris, Chattanooga Film Festival.
Who is actually CD2, and your father is the other Chris, CD1. That's what we've been told by the staff.
Right over there. Hello,
right
sir.
There. They've been really amazing to us, and just to reiterate how amazing Chris is, so we flew in Thursday night, and Elric Kane and I were traveling all day through various airports where we decided to drink at every stop along the way.
Yeah. And
so
they
let's
document
get into our weird movie list straight away.
I'm curious.
So they're
about
documenting
this story,
their entire travel through drinks on Instagram. So like every couple of hours, there they are with another beer or another shot or a Bloody Mary.
What else are we going to do?
Yeah.
Margarita.
And so, so Thursday was great. I loved meeting everybody, and then I had to carry Kane home because
I was happy. I was so happy.
He was very happy.
So just at like 2:30 in the morning, I'm in bed reading, and we're all staying at the same Airbnb. It's like the Real World Shockwaves. It's really cool.
It's like a roasting.
It really is. We need to go on Facebook Live, like the Real World.
Yeah,
Shockwaves.
Real World Shockwaves.
Chattanooga.
So at 2:30, I get a text from Rob, and it says, "Kane's drunk. I've never seen him like this. Help." And I get dressed and I see the Lyft pull up, and then
it's not the Lyft, it was Chris's car. And his girlfriend dropped us off. And by the way, at this point Elric had already thrown up on himself several times.
And so Elric came, like, Rob lifts him out of the car. He is covered in puke.
I didn't eat dinner. Let's just go back a step. I walked into the party saying I should eat a burrito, and then people started handing me whiskey. That's all the last thing I remember.
You're welcome.
And yeah, so yeah. Then the place where we're staying,
the people at home will have no idea who that voice is. I love it.
I'm pretend Ryan Turek because I'm in all black.
Another producer,
black,
it's fine.
Yeah, another producer. Boots. It's cool. But so Rob and I had to kind of sling Elric over our shoulders and carry him up the steps into the door. And he was hitting like every third step, maybe. And then we get him upstairs and we're trying to get him into his room. And he finally gets there. And I'm like, Kane, you can't go into the bed like this. It's not your bed. And you're covered in puke. And he looks at me, and it was the most straight thing he'd said all night long. And he goes, Becca, I did not puke.
Because even when I'm inebriated, I disagree.
He's
going to
argue with me.
He can't argue.
I could be dead and I'd still be grumbling.
And so I was like, Kane, just at least take your coat off. And he pulls it over his head like a shirt.
Yeah.
And handed it to me.
Guys.
And that,
it's clean
that was,
now. She cleaned it.
I cleaned it. I washed it.
And that is a wonderful human right there.
It smelled.
And he remembers none of this, by the way, because the next day he's like, oh, I can't wait to meet the two Chris's. And we're like,
no, I'd met this Chris Sr. and I woke up that morning going, I can't wait to meet Chris Jr. today. And then I looked at my phone and there's photos of us hugging. And I was like, fuck.
And that's
like,
how
I haven't had that since college. So this is not regular. I feel like $1 million today, though. So that's
but here, so the punchline is that Chris told me right before this that he listens to Shockwaves in his car. And now he is honored that he will continue to listen to Shockwaves in the car that Elric threw up in.
Love
and
you,
that's
Chris.
How
Love
you
it.
Fucking start a film
that's
festival.
How you rock it, you know?
Okay, our show is usually not like this.
Yes.
Just so you know. But
not since the drunken debates. That was close to this.
Yes, way back then. Close.
I want to say a quick something at the top of this, which is sitting to the left of me is not just my co-host today, but a filmmaker who showed a movie here, and I was super excited for you to show your movie yesterday, and also Dave McKendry, who's recording this. You guys premiered, I think, this first screening.
Yeah,
right?
It's literally like five people had seen it before last night.
So yeah, next to you cleaning my jacket, that's the best thing you've ever done. It's really cool. Oh, Marnie is up there too.
Yeah, Marnie's pretty cool.
But no, it's a really fun movie, and it's like, and I say that because people who listen to us and hear us disagree all the time. Like early on, it's not like my genre or tone, like the comedy horror. And so I was a little like, oh, am I going to even like this? And I was so.
What's the name of it?
All the creatures are stirring.
Thank you.
I have to say it twice, but I think you really made a fun, like really a lot of love, and you lean into like the low budget nature in a way that really works for it. So. First review of the festival is yours.
Thank you so much,
Kane. So congrats.
Wow. Dude.
I'm not always mean to you.
I'm going
to
give you a
sometimes, hug. Sometimes, you know. People don't know that about us.
Well, thank you so much. No, it was an awesome
Enough
premiere
about
last
you.
Night.
Let's
no, seriously, we got lots to cover because I've seen a lot of good stuff here, and so have you. And we also have we should now introduce
the voice of God.
We should introduce surrogate Turek.
I think we don't.
No,
don't
no,
for
no
a
just
while.
Pretend Turek. Let everybody else try to figure out who that is.
Okay, pretend Turek.
The smooth,
but
dulcet
you've
voice.
Been on. Wait, have you? You've been on before, haven't
I
you?
I haven't.
You
no.
have never
he
been
hasn't
on
been
before.
Been invited.
No, no. There's a
that's
reason.
Why he's crashing this.
I thought you were on.
I wasn't invited to this either.
For some reason, I thought you were on.
Pretty much.
It's true.
Should we talk about a lifetime ban? That's something like that was talked about.
I mean, I've been banned from a lot of places,
okay.
And it,
you
doesn't,
can't remember.
It doesn't work.
I thought you were on for Spring for some reason. Oop, that's a hint.
I was not.
Oh, man.
My longtime collaborators have been on
yeah.
your podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
But I have not been invited.
Okay.
All right, I'm going to tell everyone. This is Lou Tyler Pucci. This is him. He got on our show. Our ratings just boosted. All right, yeah, well, let's talk about the couple of movies we saw before we get into it.
Yeah, so I'm going to kick off with one that is not horror because I'm being on brand for me. So the very first night we were here, I watched a documentary on ramen called Ramen Heads, which I was kind of like, this sounds bizarre, but, you know, we wanted to see it. And it's like food porn the entire time. And we actually left and went to get ramen because it was so good.
Oh, wow.
So it just proved to me that you can make a documentary about anything and make it really interesting and riveting. And I was so fascinated through the whole thing. Like, there's a ritual to ramen. So completely not hard, but see Ramen Heads because it was great.
I saw Revenge and it did not make me want to do what was in it. It made me feel bad about being a man. But I will say, we sat through Joe Bob's breakdown of sexploitation, which was brilliant, and especially like he brings such a history buff quality to it, which is so fun, and it was the best setup. This will actually go down in one of my favorite screenings, going from 3 hours of him talking about sexploitation to seeing Revenge right after, where it's literally every element that's being exploited in his conversation is exploited in that film. And the woman who directed it has just a really incredible aesthetic. This film, as it builds, it just moves. It kind of goes 10 to midnight at the end, which blew my mind because I don't know if she would have seen that or not, but either way, it was kind of exciting. It's a rape revenge film, but what they do differently, and I don't think I could need to see another rape revenge film made, especially by a man, right? Like, you know what I mean? And that, not even to be political, just we've seen it, and then they're always sexualized. With this, what happens is they build the female lead to be sex on a stick, and they basically make her an object in the first few minutes, and then when the rape happens, they don't go there. They don't fetishize the rape. It's just this ugly thing not seen. And then when she you know, makes the change, I'm not going to go past there for spoilers, but it goes to a place that was really surprising and exciting. Kind of reminded me of seeing Raw, where you're like, oh, this is a new vision. Whatever this person makes, I am on board to see what they do. But I think the last 20 minutes in terms of action directing and just kind of exciting editing and pacing is pretty astounding. So people should definitely check it out, even if you're squeamish about that subgenre, which I would understand. Great, great flick.
Nice.
Wow.
I haven't seen barely anything except Becca's movie so far. But no, I've been doing... The cool thing about this festival is I do like the presentations and kind of the things that are unique to it. So I was with Elric for the Joe Bob Briggs one, but we just saw Grady Hendrix do a live version of Paperbacks from Hell, which is amazing. I'd started reading the book, but only a couple chapters, and what's amazing is now I have his voice in my head, so when I go back to resume, it will take on a whole new life and meaning. But... it's just much like the Joe Bob thing. It gave us such an incredible history of kind of the origin of horror paperback books all the way from the 60s to the 90s. And, you know, we had Grady on. A lot of people told me that they discovered him through our bonus episode of Shockwaves.
Oh, that's terrific.
And he's a really talented guy, really funny guy. You know, a couple of novels under his belt, including this Paperbacks from Hell, which is more of a, you know, obviously a history sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And so that was super cool, and I'm kind of nervous that we had to follow that.
Yeah.
But here we are.
Last night I saw Dementia 2,
is it true that that film was made in 4 minutes?
It might be five. We actually have the writer, director, editor,
Mercer.
Producers.
Oh,
Matt Mercer and my testin sitting in the house here. So, yeah. Hi. How long did it take to make, guys? 5 days? Which is... A script to screen in a month, which
this is the worst
absolutely
interview we've ever done.
Guy in
back of
room,
yelling shit out.
Thank you, guy in back of room.
Next to me, this is crazy.
Guys, I'll answer for him. It took. We did 4 days, and then we started the edit, and we realized that we needed one more day of pickups. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think I'm getting.
Wow. Surrogate so Turek knows his shit.
So then we went back and we did one more day of pickups, and then we had 2 more weeks of doing the edit, and then went into a rough sound design and coloring before it premiered in Chicago. Did I get all of that right?
Did he get all that right?
Yes. Wow.
You got to do Joe Bob next.
Well, I got to say,
hour, just do Joe Bob.
It's an incredibly fun film, set entirely in one location, but you don't feel it. And if anything, it leans on it, but it's really smart in the way that it leans on it. I compare it to Dead Alive.
That took more than 5 days.
No, I know, but it definitely got the same body humor feel. It's got the same kind of uncomfortability without being completely comedic or over the top, cool. Even though Dead Alive does push there at times. It's got this kind of like so squeamish that you start laughing at moments. So it was a lot of fun.
Is that what's playing again?
Has nothing to do with Dementia 1.
That's what I was going to ask. It's actually not a part 2 at all.
No. I think the title Dementia also was floated last night, which I think is great.
I think
great,
they were claiming for advertising that it's the Demon 3 ogre of its type. That was the thing they were leaning on for fans of Demon 3.
Probably
the
Evil
ogre.
Dead 9 or something like that.
Just
we're
really
there.
Really random. yeah. I saw ghost stories. Oh, shit. Lou's gone. That was like a ghost story, wasn't it?
Yeah, he
I needed a sound effect. Ghost Stories is utterly incredible. I just walked out of that, and I was completely floored. It's going to be, it's like top five of the year type material. That's how good that movie is. So if it plays again here, go to it. I had no expectations. I'd heard it's based on an amazing stage play.
I think
play.
It plays again on Sunday.
I think it has one more. It really is, it's exactly my kind of horror. It's just, it's super creepy, and it feels like an old-time spook show, like Dead of Night was the comparable I'd feel, but so modern, and unlike most anthologies where we're going off in different directions, this all comes beautifully together, and it's really good.
Do you mean the 1930s Dead of Night? Not the 70s.
So yeah, that one doesn't all come together. But it's really good. So if you haven't seen it, I know this is probably painful to people listening at home going, oh, wait 4 months for that, you know. But anyway.
It's coming.
Yeah, it's coming. It's really good.
Yeah.
So, I think that catches up us.
Yeah. I've got some
introduce our mystery guest that disappeared? I can't even remember. But we have another
new mystery guest, and he's been on the show before.
I'm Dave Lawson.
Oh, Dave Lawson. Hi, Dave Lawson.
Oh, I feel like we need to introduce him.
Piss him off when he came back in. And
this is a killer POV flashback right here.
Yeah, welcome back. I'm going to say his name. Jeremy Gardner, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thank you. Now I feel bad. I was just trying to piss Dave off, but I jumped the line of guests.
Yeah, that's okay. You're here. There's no order. No rhyme or reason
for
this.
Hold on to you for a minute, Jeremy.
Yeah.
Where the hell you been for the last, like, 4 years?
Yeah, we had you back on for Battery a couple of years ago.
Yeah, well, you know when you make a movie and then you go have to work in a bar for 4 years because no one will let you make another one? Yeah.
That's
all right. Great.
And I got to tell
All right, next guest. This is a downer.
Yeah, no.
Push the button. Where's the...
You know what? I was thinking the whole time I was sitting over there, I can't wait to get up there and just talk about how puke-fucking-drunk Elric was the other day. And then you already did.
I was fun.
So
I know.
Nothing left to say.
Sorry. We took the wind out of your sails.
Yeah.
I will say, though, you did make another film after the... We love The Battery. If you haven't seen it, of course, go back and see it. It's one of my favorites of the last, like, decade. But you also made... Yeah, let's applause to
The
Battery.
Yeah, it's great.
And your filmmaking partner over there, too.
But Crystal. Tex is pretty damn fun.
Tex
Montana
right.
I love is a
Tex
lot
Montana.
Of fun. And you had released... Let me ask you this really quick. You chose to release it kind of for free, or you did... Explain why you released it the way you did, because you were trying something new.
Well, we decided that, you know, sometimes it takes so goddamn long to get all your residuals back when you make a small movie, and people need that money to live. So we're like, what if we just, instead of kickstarting... a budget to make a movie. We just made the movie, then kickstarted the money that we imagined we would get if we waited 3 years and went through traditional distribution routes, and we just released the whole movie for free. And then that worked, and then we still had to go work in a bar.
There you go.
So if you really want that
Lord.
Movie going,
Lawson is back
somewhere.
With beer.
The bar Lawson right. has brought Bruce.
Fine, so be it.
Which Kane, you may partake in mind.
I'm back.
I just wanted to crash this, but it's been taking a long time. But we might have a cool thing to reveal tomorrow night.
Oh hell yeah!
So you're doing your podcast at a shitty time.
This will not come out.
This won't air.
No, but it's more. It's more for these people.
There's people in the room, and they have Twitter. So,
Dave, take your chair back.
Well, I'm excited to hear what you're announcing tomorrow night. So everyone has to keep posted to hear what Jeremy Gardner's announcement
is. Yeah, and everybody has to hang around tomorrow and not leave. And if you want to see some of the most terrible shit you've ever seen, we're going to show some of the most terrible shit we've ever made at our a little class tomorrow night.
Oh, nice. Cool. Nice. Nice.
Well, terrible shit. We'll see, cool. we'll see you in the next cool. thing. I want my shirt back. All right.
And Lawson, get back up here.
Wait, oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. Well, I figured he might want to
Can we wait till he's had a couple beers?
No, I figured he would want to plug his movie.
Oh, which movie?
Yeah, you're here for a movie.
I am?
You're promoting something here, are you not?
I think
it is screening here.
The
Are
Endless.
You just screening
oh,
something?
Oh, right. The Endless is playing.
Exactly. Don't make me
this
be your marketing
idea,
dude. I know.
Guys,
bad
this
idea.
This is doing great. Yeah, no. So we it actually just came out theatrically yesterday in New York. Rolls out to L.A. next week and then goes a bit wider after that. So we're really excited to bring it back to Chattanooga because we were very sad that we couldn't show it last year. We really tried to do it as a secret screening because it was about to premiere at Tribeca and they would not let us do it. But we really fought. I wanted to show it to Chris. I wanted to bring the DCP and just show Chris the DCP like one night after hours because he's always been such a fan. So.
And I saw it at Tribeca, and people, I love mindfuck movies, and this is a great mindfuck film. And it's also a film that, you know, it connects beautifully in their filmography. I'm not going to go into spoilers, but I don't know what you can really say in terms of the plot.
Yeah, I think it's best just going in not knowing anything. However, I will say one thing. All three of their films all connect,
mm-hmm.
and there is a very specific order in which chronologically they connect. So if you ever want to go back through them and try to figure it out, they all do connect.
Oh, interesting. Huh. I didn't realize that. That's cool.
Interesting.
So that's playing one time only. Is that today?
I think it's playing soon. I might have to go to
I think it's so if any of you leave, we won't be too offended.
Is it 4:30? Great.
Okay, cool.
We'll wrap this up. 4:30, so Joe Bob can have my seat.
Nice.
What was the, like, this one was, just, I talk a little bit about the making of this one, because I like that Justin and Aaron were talking about, they could have just, again, like the spirit of even what Jeremy was just talking about, you could wait to make that dream film that you're waiting on for, till you die, or for 5 years, or you can make something in between and just do it.
Yeah, and I mean, that's what it really stemmed from. They have a couple projects that are in the higher budget ranges that are just getting stuck in casting, and it's just a long process mm-hmm. once you start talking about higher risk. And so they came to me and like, we got this fuck you movie that we want to make because we don't need anybody else's money. We can go make this with our money. And I was like, hey guys, let's still get somebody else's money because maybe we can get paid on this one and that would be great.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what it stemmed from. It's just that, you know, not wanting to be complacent. And they always like to say they're storytellers, not meeting takers. And so this was just a way for them to go and tell another story.
Were you resistant to have them be the leads? Or, I mean, that was probably obviously part of the plan of the film.
It was part of the plan of the film, but I did make them not audition for me, but I did go and watch some of the rehearsals.
Oh, wow. I want you to audition them, like very formal.
There is, I will say this, if you buy the physical disc, one of the extras is us auditioning for our own roles, and also all of us auditioning for the role of Aaron. That we did.
So you're all playing Aaron?
Yeah,
so
we did that before we shot the movie, going, you know what would be really funny on the DVD? And so we put that, so that's there along with a bunch of other stuff.
What's your character name? Smiling?
Smiling Dave.
It's one of the highlights of the film. Seriously, it's really fun.
Please stop saying
it's
that.
Really, no, it is. It's fun.
I really hate it. It was not fun.
Aw.
Well, you were fun.
Well, thank you.
It's not up for debate.
Thank you.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, Dave Lawson.
All right, I'm
going to
get off somebody else.
Yeah.
We're going to keep this train going.
Yeah, I'm bringing up Jen. Jen Wexler, ladies and gentlemen.
Jen Wexler.
And
in the house.
The director of The Ranger.
Yeah. For the past couple of weeks leading up to this, when we talked about Chattanooga Film Festival, I always said that one of the films I really wanted to see was The Ranger. Because Jen and I, we played like a ton of short film festivals together, like all around the same time.
And then they placed your film at the same time as her film.
And then we played back to back.
I haven't seen your guys' film
yet. Yeah, we haven't seen yours yet.
Yeah.
So.
I have. And okay, I like The Ranger. I can endorse The Ranger.
Excellent. Excellent. I love punk rock spirit in any film. So I'm just excited to see it. So tell us a little bit about The Ranger.
Yeah, so it's about a bunch of punks. They get in trouble with the cops, and they go to the woods to hide out, where they come up against the ranger.
This gets slashery, right?
It gets slashery. No, it was kind of like a melding of all of my co-writer, Jaco Farino, and my favorite things, which is like a mix of like absurd like 80s punk movie humor and slasher stuff. And it also follows this like girl's story. And it just kind of, oh, and also it's very inspired by the color palette of Lisa Frank.
Oh, nice.
So
that just made me giddy.
So yeah, kind of like took all that stuff together and made a movie.
You know what's funny? I don't know if I told you this off air, but I just discovered Vinegar Syndrome puts out a lot of weird shit.
Yep.
And I just discovered a movie they put out called Punk Vacation, which I watched right before your movie, and I was like, holy shit, that weird like theme in the air. I don't know if you've ever seen or heard of it, but and that's the only element is there's punks in both, basically,
there's
that are very
involved.
Eccentric looking and stuff.
Yeah, totally.
But was that as important? I mean, is that part of your sensibility? It's just kind of like you grew up on punk music and stuff like that, that you wanted to infuse in it?
Because
it's got that identity that's unique to it.
Yeah, I think, there was a mix of things that happened to me when I was about 10 years old, which is that my family moved towns, and I had no friends, so I just poured myself into horror movies, and then eventually started going to shows, and this was just like such a, you know, anything that happens when you're like 12 years old, the stuff you watch when you're 12 is the stuff that like kind of makes you who you are. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was just like horror movies and punk music and stuff, and we, you know, Heather Buckley, who may or may not be in this room, I guess she's not, she's one of the producers on the movie, and she read the script, and she very much identified with the characters. Actually, she identifies most with the ranger, she would say. she wanted to be the ranger. I told her no. But, yeah, we just kind of, like, teamed up, and then we got it made.
Now, did you guys shoot in New York?
We did. We shot in Brooklyn and upstate New York, like near Woodstock.
Nice.
And this is a Glass Eye Picks production?
A Glass Eye Picks movie and also a Hood River Entertainment movie. It was Larry Fessenden and Andrew Vandenhouten. And I was a big fan of Andrew's movies, like The Woman and Jug Face and All She Later Is Die. Huge fan. So when he showed interest in the project, I was just very excited.
He makes a lot of films in the woods.
Lots of movies in the woods.
That feels like the aesthetic there.
Yes.
Is there a Larry cameo?
Absolutely.
All right, sold.
Excellent.
It's all tips. We're easy.
We're Larry fans.
Anytime we make a movie, we kind of are like, okay, which character are we going to ask Larry to play? Which one? And Larry's just like grumbling and like, okay, just tell me where I need to be and when.
So when will people listening to this at home, when will this be like in their domain, theaters or VOD, or do you know yet?
We're just like starting all that stuff.
So we
just,
festivals.
Yeah, we premiered a couple weeks ago, and now we're going to be at Overlook and some other festivals. So we're doing we're going on tour with The Ranger is what we're doing. And soon enough, it'll be in everybody's home.
Awesome. Yay. Awesome.
Excellent.
Thank you.
We will see it tomorrow.
Yeah. Cool. Thanks so much for joining us,
Thanks,
Jed.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. We have one last short guest before we get to the main event.
Which is
Cool Hand.
Yes.
Okay. So if anyone knows me for the last couple of years, I saw.
We were at. It was Knoxville.
Because I programmed it for the Hollywood Underground, but I don't remember how it came into my domain. Maybe he will. I saw Crowhand. I thought it was hilarious, a really short, just totally bizarre and bonkers. And it's one of those things where you would see it and expect maybe never to hear of that person again. You just assume they died quietly and no one ever discovered them, that kind of death. But I loved it. And then when another movie came out by the same guy, and it is literally one of my favorite movies of that year, like period, called Gwilliam.
He did not shut up about this.
I kept talking about it. It is so perverse. And this is like the natural successor to Frank Hohenlotter, in my opinion. I don't know what you'll do when you finally make a feature, but come on in here, Brian Lanano. Welcome.
You make me wish I was dead, I guess.
Yeah, no.
No, you're making brilliance, dude. We need you to continue.
Elric, he gave me these the other night, and I'm going to give them to you right now.
The Gwilliam stickers?
Yes, I need more Gwilliam stickers. And you got to lean in a little bit to the mic,
sorry,
sir. There you
I have
go.
More Gwilliam stickers.
Gwilliam,
I want Gwilliam stickers.
When we get to the main feature here, we're talking to Joe Bob about some of the weirder films we've seen. This would probably be the weirdest film I've ever seen.
I definitely have to agree with that, yeah.
Especially sexually. It made me feel strange sexually. You know when you get shrinkage at the beach? This, it went inside me. That's how cold and weird it made me feel. It's, all right, I went too far. Anyway.
No, but we watched this last year for the Knoxville Film Festival, which Elric and I judged last year. And
William's here in the audience.
Yeah, hi, William. Knoxville Film Festival. And Elric and I had both watched this for that festival, and we watched the films around the same time. And I remember that night, like, Elric texted me and was like, did you fucking watch Gwilliam yet? And I was like, I just watched it. I don't know what to think, man. I loved it, but I don't know what to think. I feel weird. And it was just, it sticks with you. And it's weird. It's rare that I see a short that a year later I'm still like, but have you seen Gwilliam?
Awesome. Thank you so much.
So why are you so weird?
I don't know.
Cut to the chase here.
I think I come off pretty normal, but then the films I make are anything but. I don't know. I just want to tell stories that everybody can relate to.
Best I've ever had. Let's start with Crowhand, because Crowhand really is a great, like when you're programming festivals, I remember, I think I had played at Boston Underground. That
it
might
did.
Have been where I heard of it from. You want something like short and punchy, and this thing, it's kind of like a gag based on a gag, but you take it so far and you just push each element as far as you can stretch, and I love that about it. It's such a great, where'd that one come from?
So that one, it says at the beginning of it that it's based on a true story, so it is partially, obviously. Not the latter half of it, but I was with my wife, Tori, who's in the audience, Hey, honey. We were at a festival in Florida, and we got our passes, and we're walking to the parking lot, and I looked down on the ground, and there literally is like a thing that looks like a crow totem on the ground. And I was like, oh, look at this cool thing, hon. It's awesome. And when I was a kid, I would like pick up weird shit like that and keep it. And she's like, that's creepy. Don't pick it up. Like, eh, what's going to happen? So like I joked that like I didn't listen to her and my hand transformed to a crow and I yelled, crow man.
A natural element.
And we both laughed and we were like, we should make that. That should be a movie. So literally like...
Bless you. That's awesome.
So literally from like the idea to like the finished product, it took like, that was April to like... I think we're finished in like August. Okay. So just like a summer.
Super quick.
Yeah, wow. It was super quick. And then when we were at, we got into South by Southwest, amazingly enough. That was the second U.S. screening. The first U.S. screening was at Hollywood Underground.
And what? I know, that was the first?
You were his first? Oh, yeah. My gosh.
And I remember exactly how, because I know a guy named Mike Everleth who ran it.
Yeah, he ran it with me.
Yes, exactly. Uh-huh. So he had seen the movie, and I think that's how it got looked in.
There you go.
And I had no idea Kenneth Anger was there. That's cool.
Yeah, Kenneth Anger opened it. I got him to cut film. I brought some Super 8 film, Kenneth Anger. I didn't know he was alive. And I'm not just saying that. I actually thought I had read his passing at some point, and then
no,
he was sitting there.
I own Vincent Gallo's Demon, right, which was given story. To him by Kenneth Anger. He's still
but
alive.
He still has this quality. I mean, he's got Lucifer tattooed across his chest, you know, from back in the 70s when he was making his incredible films. But yeah, he cut the ribbon, and so he sat there and watched your film.
That's awesome. I was just about to ask, did he watch Crow Hands?
He sat there for the whole thing. He didn't leave.
Good. It's only like 2 minutes.
He made it through.
He got through your film.
Now, I want to know about Gwilliam. Like, I want to know where this came from, where the idea originated.
Yeah. Like I said, it's something we've all been through. And
Can you explain the plot? Because some people here are just hearing us talk about things. Like, explain why this is so weird so people know what you're doing.
So my brother and I came up with this, like, weird... I don't know. We were just, like, riffing one late night, and we were talking about this guy who, like, gets out of prison, and he wants to, like, get off, you know, because he's, like, all horned up. And it was basically like a weird prowler taxi driver kind of thing. And then he just comes across this alleyway, and that's where he meets Gwilliam. And Gwilliam gives him... Originally,
what is Gwilliam? Explain Gwilliam.
Gwilliam is a goblin who gives...
He looks like that.
Who gives blowjobs.
A BJ goblin.
And originally, like, he was going to give him, the worst one ever. Mm. But then when my wife and I wrote it... Yes, I wrote this with my wife. Wow. She says, like, no, it's got to be more positive. Let's make it, like, the best blowjob he's ever gotten. And I think she's totally in the right because, like, it's all about, like, appearances can be deceiving kind of thing. And, like, really, like, it's, like, if I had to, like, boil it down to, like, a very simplistic thing, it's, like, about guilty pleasures and, like, how, like, you know it's wrong. It feels good. You feel gross and guilty afterwards. But then, like, you're ultimately going to do that again. So, like, I always use the comparison that I, like, love Nutella. And I would eat a jar of Nutella. And then I would feel like shit afterwards. Yeah. But I'd be like, I'm going to get Nutella again.
Yeah. I get it.
Yeah, it's exactly. Like watching Deadly Prey. Yeah. Whoever has the Deadly Prey shirt. Yeah. Like watching Deadly
That's
Prey.
That's your Gwilliam.
So it's something we can all relate to.
Yeah. And I haven't seen the new one, which really bummed me out. The movie I was in last night got out like 10 minutes too late to see your film. So tell us a little about it and what other places it's going to screen.
Absolutely. This one is in a totally different direction, but not quite either. It's called BFF Girls, and this spawned back in, like, actually, I wanted to make a movie this wild and crazy ever since I saw the movie House. Mm-hmm. The 1977 movie
House.
Definitely one of the weirdest movies.
Yeah, exactly. It blew my mind, and I didn't realize, like, movies can go that crazy. So I always wanted to make a film with that aesthetic, and my wife and I watched Sailor Moon on Hulu. We just binge watched tons of Sailor Moon, and I knew about it, but I watched a lot of Power Rangers and Powerpuff Girls and whatever. But I was like, we should do something. Like, let's, like, sort of, like, poke fun at, like, people who are, like, super into Japanese culture. Like, I forget what they're called, like otaku or something like that. And then, like, but let's have them actually transform into Japanese superheroes. Like, that's their superpower, is they can transform into Japanese superheroes. And then we came up with a plot, like, where one of them gets their period for the first time, so they battle a tampon monster named Auntie Flo. So that's what it's about.
All right.
Again, something I'm sure half of the audience can relate to.
Completely.
Not him.
Yeah, no. I'm in.
But it was like we wanted it to be, like, really colorful and really stylish. Like, we try to use as many practical effects, but our whole finale sequence is, like, all on green screen. And there's another film by that Obayashi, a filmmaker, he did called School in the Crosshairs, which is, like, okay, but the last, like, 12 minutes in that weird dimension on Venus, like, totally, like, blew my mind and inspired me to, like, do something like that. So, but this has been, like, in the works for, like, 3 years. My wife and I wrote the script, like, 3 years ago, after Gwilliam was finished, and we were just, you know, just took a long time to finally get it made and funded. And
can stuff. They see the other two films online?
Yeah, is Gwilliam and Crowhand online?
Crowhand is online for free. You can get it on my Vimeo page. You can all, it's, there's a bunch of it, versions like ripped on YouTube and stuff. But Gwilliam is a little more special. You have to go to my Vimeo page and you can rent it or buy it because a couple other people picked up my shorts and got distribution, but I wanted to do this one myself. I held Gwilliam close to the chest.
Mm-hmm. You should do, as a gimmick, you should do a money-back guarantee. Oh, so if they watch it and don't feel like it's the best they've ever had, you give them their money back. It will spike your sales through the roof, I'm telling you. Because it is the best I've ever had.
When we were on the festival circuit, we had the gimmick we had was we had the theaters filled with barf bags, just in case. And then everybody was like, oh my God, am I really going to throw up, Brian? I was like, no. I don't know.
Maybe. I have a barf bag collection. I actually do.
Really?
I do. I collect, Rob's seen it because I used to have it hanging up in the office. I collect, because that was a common marketing thing in the 70s. So like I have Tombs of the Blind Dead and Mark of the Devil and all the different films that did barf bags as marketing.
That's
so
awesome.
I really need a Gwilliam one.
Okay, I'll see
they
if I can
did
find
them
it.
For Raw when it screamed at CineFamily, and it was just a paper bag with Raw written on
That's
it in
what
marker.
I did. Yeah.
And I framed it because I have to. That's what I do.
We bought like 1,000 white Uline bags, and my wife made this like customized rubber stamp, and I was just sit like the night before a festival just stamping like
that is awesome.
You know, myself.
Somebody
has to do that. I'm not going to make anyone else do that.
Well, I am stoked that you have a new film, and I'm just so curious when you do develop this into like a feature, what you're working on, the kind of style you have. I'm really curious what will happen.
I don't know either. I really want to find a story that I want to do as a feature because, like, there's a lot of films and filmmakers out there where they want to do features. I love shorts so much, but, like, they want to do features, so they make, like, a short version of their feature and then show it off so that way they can get interest and money to... But every idea I have is a short film. Like, I can't expand on Crowhand.
Yeah, I don't think you need
and
to force
I don't know,
it.
I don't know if I want to know like why Gwilliam is the way he is. Like, he should just be that.
Gwilliam origin story, come on.
Yeah, well, I did have this sort of like idea. Like, I came up with a history in my head about him. Like, he came over on the Mayflower and was like blowing pilgrims under the under the boat and stuff.
Okay, see, now I want to see the feature.
I love that. That's so good.
We joked about a feature and we said like it was literally going to be like the short film for 6 minutes and then the rest of it was going to be like blue is the warmest color. Between a man and a goblin.
That makes total sense. All right, we can't top that. Well, thank you for coming, and I hope you guys get to see
thank
some of his films.
Yes, awesome. Please check out some of his films.
Thanks, Brian. Well...
You've been waiting a long time, so you deserve this intro.
Well, when we started Killer POV, and who was a Killer POV listener? Okay.
Wow.
So that's 5 years ago. We started a podcast. As some of you will know, we were put together. I knew Becca, didn't really know Rob.
We were like the boy band of horror.
Yeah, somebody was asked who to put together for a podcast. They put us together. First few episodes are a little rocky.
They literally put us in a room and were like, this is Rob, this is Elric, go. And we were like, okay.
And then we did that for 100 and, I don't know, a couple hundred episodes.
Yeah. 40? 140.
140 episodes, and we made the leap to Blumhouse and just big money. It rains on
us. Yeah, it's just constant, just making it rain.
Where I make my Purge pitches every
week. That is sarcasm, by the way.
On deaf ears, Purge Predator. Hashtag, we can make this happen, guys.
Hey, they give us free LaCroix at Blumhouse. Right. We get free LaCroix.
One of the only reason I'm going back there is because, like, for me, there's like a handful of people. We've done like 200 episodes and we've met some pretty amazing people. There's like two or three, and we have one being Carpenter, who we haven't had yet. One was definitely Larry Cohen, who was like, just because he's such a good raconteur, great storyteller,
that
is one of my favorite episodes. One of the people I mentioned really early on that I would love to meet, and somebody, the reason I view, yesterday there was an intro to Joe Bob by Chris Dortch Sr., where he's talking about how it shaped his son so much, and I can say the same thing. A lot of the way we on our show value movies, and we are not haters, we don't talk about the movies, we don't tend to talk much about the movies we dislike. It's really a place to celebrate that all movies are equal, you know what I mean? Like, whether you're talking about cinema, like Joe kept saying yesterday, like the Citizen Kane, or whether we're talking about Deadly Prey, there's something to be loved in each of these things and enjoy saying from. So for me, somebody who approaches movies that way was a big deal. And when seeing somebody talk on TV about it, like legitimizing that person talking about these movies that you know weren't sure if you were really meant to enjoy, was a big deal. And also in New Zealand, I grew up with, and I've talked about him before, Ant Timpson had a film festival there, and his film festival guide basically completely ripped off Joe Bob. And it was basically done in the same way where he'd write how many decapitations, how many crocodile symbols, and so he really took that style and made it kind of popular. Like sorry, forgive me for a second, but fuck thumbs up, thumbs down. Sorry, Ibra Sisko, that is not how to look at movies.
That's not it.
What we want to know is how many heads are decapitated, you know, how many crocodiles, you know. So that's my long-winded way of saying I've been waiting for a very long time to meet the great Joe Bob Briggs.
And here he is.
Welcome.
Well, I think that was a very nice way of saying that I was your 201st choice as a guest.
Well, we got there. And thanks for yesterday's. Everything is exploitation. That was great.
Thoroughly entertaining.
It was long, wasn't it?
I don't know. We do podcasts for 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
What do we know?
We talk forever.
Somebody in the audience just went, oh, fuck, I'm in this room for that long. I didn't look this up.
I think we need to mention the announcement that you made before your presentation, mm-hmm. because Shudder sponsors Shockwaves pretty regularly.
Yep.
So what are you doing
episode?
For Shudder?
You know, well, let me just preface this by saying that ever since I went off the air at TNT, about once a year, some network comes around and says, hey, we might want to do something with you. And I always say, you know, the network canceled me, and so now the people must suffer. And no, I mean, people have talked about doing this from time to time. So Shudder comes and they say, you want to do something. And I say, well, you know, the only thing I can do is the exact same show that I've done for two previous networks. And they said, fine, we love that, do it, you know. And so we're doing a 24-hour nonstop Joe Bob Briggs horror marathon called The Last Drive-In. On a Friday in June, starts on a Friday night in June. They haven't picked a Friday night yet. A little bit disorganized at that place. But
Sam
Zimmerman
calling you out. Just cut you down.
But we're going to do, it's called The Last Drive-In, and it's 13 movies, and we're going to interrupt the movies for commercial breaks, even though we don't have any commercials. It's just me being annoying, interrupting the movie. And it's basically the Monster Vision show. It has all the same elements. And
Will you be picking the movies? Will it be your choice, or...?
They have a list of movies that they have licenses for. Yeah. And I said, do you want me to do good movies? You want me to do bad movies? You want me to do obscure movies? Because I know them all. You know? And they said, well, let's do a mix. And so, for example, I'll give one away. They're not going to announce the movies in advance, but I'm going to give one away to your show.
Exclusive.
The opener is a movie called Tourist Trap with Chuck Connors.
Love it.
Yeah. Now, see, your audience knows what I'm talking about. Yeah. The general public doesn't know Tourist Trap. Yeah. And in fact, Tourist Trap came out with the same producer as Halloween, same year. You know, and of course, he was pissed about Tourist Trap because Tourist Trap was a bomb. I mean, nobody went to Tourist Trap. And then over the years, and it's a weird movie.
It is.
I mean, I would argue that it has an internal sense. You know, it has an internal logic. Yeah. But, you know, if you really write down the plot points in Tourist Trap, it doesn't make a lick of sense on the surface. Yeah. You know.
But somehow, mannequins.
But if you kind of say, you know, well, it's magic realism going on here, you know, then you can sort of make sense of Tourist Trap. But it's got these elements that we would know about, you know, because we've watched it, you know, more than once. But it doesn't, it's never registered with the public. So I thought, well, that's the perfect kind of movie because, you know, it's like you can totally nerd out on it. Yeah. You can just analyze it to death, you know, and it has an interesting backstory.
Is that going to be your challenge to make it make sense, internal logic, explain
it? I can make it make sense.
Okay. I want to hear that.
Yeah, I do. I want the plot points, the breakdown. Because somehow, even though that it's kind of, you know, doesn't make sense, it's absolutely terrifying.
The thing that's difficult to explain is the... telekinetic powers of Davy.
Yeah.
You know, is exactly how these people, and if you don't have the telekinetic powers, there's no movie because the first kill is within the first 5 minutes, you know, and it's all telekinetic, you know. And one interesting thing about the movie is that, you know, Charles Band was somehow involved with it. I don't remember how. He was the producer?
He is the producer.
Okay. So he wasn't doing dolls before that movie. So it's actually David Schmoller who created the whole doll idea and later did Puppet Master. And then that's been Charles Band's whole life.
Yeah. Is that it's still all he does? His shtick.
He makes dolls, yeah. And so really, this is the one that started the whole doll thing, mm-hmm. It's just an interesting historical footnote that in 1979, here's, oh, wow, that's interesting. Let's get a factory in Guangdong that can make dolls that we can sell in connection with movies. It's all about the doll.
You're just talking about how he started with dolls, but I'm curious because one thing I've seen you speak on movies, but I have never really heard you talk about like where the starter for you in terms of your kind of love affair with movies, how young you were and the drive-in, I assume, was like a starting point for you.
Yeah, I went to the drive-in a lot. I mean, we were in... my family moved around a lot. They were school teachers, and so West Texas, Arkansas, and it was the heyday of the drive-in. And so my parents, the way the drive-ins were programmed at the time is you had a Hollywood movie as the first feature, and then you had a naughty movie as the second feature. And so the kids are in the back seat, and they're trying to stay awake long enough that they can see the naughty movie, and they never quite make it. They take you to the drive-in in your pajamas, but I could.
You trained yourself.
I could stay awake for the whole 5 hours, So,
do you remember first one that you saw that you really weren't meant to see?
Oh, wow. That would have been... the definition of naughty would have been different at the time. Because they had, like, in the 60s, they had these wild party movies, but it would just be, Jack Lemmon and a lot of supermodels, And then later they had, they started having really low-budget horror titles. Mm-hmm. Now, I couldn't tell you what they were because we never remembered the name of the movie, But it would just be a lot of dark shots. They were some of them were probably Italian. Of course, at the time, we didn't know they were Italian because they would disguise the credits and they would disguise the. There was no indication of any. It was only later that we became aware that there were all these Italian directors, because we were easily fooled. You could put a carton of Kellogg Corn Flakes on the table, and we would think it's Maine, So I'm sure a lot of them were those cheesy Italian horror films that came over in the late 60s, early 70s.
Do you remember one where you felt like that maybe scared the shit out of you as a youngster, so you knew what you were doing is taboo? Because it seems
not
like a
really
lot of
nothing
have that.
Much scared me when I was a kid. I mean, I was grown up when I remember. Does anybody remember the movie Wolfen?
Okay.
Well, the thing about Wolfen, if you saw it on the big screen, is it's the first movie ever made with a Steadicam. So you'd never seen a Steadicam shot at that time. And so if you remember, it's like these wild wolves, ravening wild wolves in the Bronx. Mm-hmm. So they're going over this wasteland of the Bronx, chasing the wolves or doing wolf point of view. And they're using the Steadicam. And when you see a Steadicam for the first time, you've never seen it in your life, it's scary. It's scary. How are they moving that camera?
Yeah, so fluidly.
And so I remember Wolfen being very scary, although I never hear anybody say Wolfen was scary. Nobody ever comes up to me and says, "Hey, would you sign this Wolfen thing?"
Well, the scariest part to me is, isn't there a scene on a bridge? Like, it's a long one take where these two characters are talking on the top of a bridge, and I'm terrified of heights. So that entire sequence to me is the scariest thing in Wolfen, is these two people on the top of a bridge.
Yeah.
Well,
and then, I thought that the Steadicam would become a staple of horror. But then 3 years later, you have Sam Raimi, and he can't afford a Steadicam, and he does all those long, what should be Steadicam shots tracking through the woods, and he's just carrying the camera on a couple of 2x4s. It works.
Genius.
But I mean, like the Steadicam in Street Trash, which would have been a couple of years later, like the Steadicam work in that is amazing, like way better than it should be in Street Trash. So
Right.
It's a great movie.
Those guys became superstars, the guys who could run the Steadicams. Mm-hmm. They're like drone operators today. Everyone thought drones would be great. But then it's like, but who can fly the drone and operate the camera at the same time? So those guys are becoming superstars.
How'd you get into writing about film? I mean, where did that start for you, going from just being someone who consumed movies to...
I was a Cub apprentice copy boy at the Arkansas Democrat at the age of 13. And so if you were a copy boy in those days, you had to write. Everybody wrote at the paper. So, you know, you wrote 6, 8, 10 articles a day. So that's how I learned to write. And then I was a sports writer. And then I was, later on, I was trying to finish a book in Dallas. I was working in Dallas. And they had an opening for the film critic. And I said, you know, I'm really tired of going out of town all the time. I got to finish this damn book. I said, can I be the film critic? Because you just watch films. And I love films. You know, can I just watch films and review the films? Well, yeah, but you have to watch everything. And I'm like, okay, I'll watch everything. And so they would screen the films, and I just hated this Hollywood mainstream stuff that I had to watch every week. I mean, it's one thing to occasionally go to the Hollywood mainstream film. To have to watch every single fucking one that comes out of Universal Pictures and Paramount, and, you know, so I was getting sick of this stuff, but I really liked the foreign films, because think about it, there's millions of foreign films, right? And only one a week makes it to Dallas, all the way to Dallas. It means it's going to be good, yeah. You know. And so the foreign films were good, and the stuff that they didn't screen for me, I was saying, why aren't you screening this stuff for me? It's premiering at the drive-in, and you know. So I would call up the distributors, hey. I missed the screening for Graveyard Tramps. When did you guys show that? We never screen our films for critics, you know? And that's how I met Roger Corman. Because Roger Corman called me and he says, hey, I saw your column. And I said, Roger, nobody's screening your films for me in Dallas. And he says, you know what? Normally I don't screen for critics, but, you know, you're a special case. And he says, call this guy Bernie. He's my guy in Dallas, and he has a theater. Go in there on Thursday morning, tell him to run the film for you. And so from then on, every Corman film, you know, I was the only critic in America, got to watch it in advance. And then I would say, Roger, you don't seem to have many stills to go with your picture. And he would say, I tell you what, John, when you go see Bernie this week, just tell him, pick a frame that you want. Tell him to cut the frame out. Splice the film back together.
Oh, my God.
Jump in it.
That is the most Corman thing ever.
Do you have any of those still? That would be worth it.
Oh, man, I wish I did. I don't. And so I got to meet all the independent film distributors at the time, including some really sketchy ones, you know. Yeah. And I would call these guys. There was a guy named Lon Kerr, Motion Picture Distributing of Marina Del Rey. And I would call up Lon, and I would say... Lon, what is Swinging Waitresses? And he would say, you already reviewed it. It's Swinging Barmaids from last year. And because they would take these movies and they would retitle them and they would send them out for a second time, you know? And so I would always have to call Lon and say, is this a movie I've already seen four times or is it a new movie? And it was in the golden days of the sub-distributors and the independent film studios. And at the time, I was the only guy reviewing these films because I always give him credit. There was one other guy. There was a guy named Bill Landis who had a fanzine called Sleazoid Express.
Which became a really good book, Sleazoid Express.
And Bill was a gay man in New York City who loved the gay underground, and he especially loved 42nd Street. Mm-hmm. And he would go to 42nd Street, and he would review not just the movie, but what was going on in the theaters of 42nd Street was sometimes, you know, more interesting than the movie. And he wrote this wonderful fanzine called Sleazoid Express. And so I was reviewing these movies at drive-ins in the Deep South, and Bill was reviewing these movies at the grindhouses of Times Square. And so I started thinking, well, so then whenever I was in New York, I would go to 42nd Street and see every possible thing because I would know that, like, within a year it was going to come through. They didn't release them all in the same place at the same time.
Yeah.
It's like they had maybe 20 prints, and so they would go across the country. It would take 2 years to get all the way across the country. So I would watch all these movies on 42nd Street, and then I'd have my reviews ready for when it came to Texas. And so that's a really long version.
No,
a really long answer to your question.
And years later, you tried to stop 42nd Street, or at least an attempt, because 42nd Street, if anyone's gone the last 10 years,
they started using public domain laws to condemn some of those theaters. Well, you know, excuse me, but those theaters were abandoned by the Great White Way, Broadway, you know, theaters. And they were taken over by entrepreneurs who kept the theaters in business. Mm-hmm. I mean, the theaters would have been torn down if it weren't for... There was one theater, the theater that today, where the Lion King plays, that theater was called Always Three Kung Fu Hits. That's the only thing, that is the only thing that was ever on the marquee. Yeah. And it was true. You could go in there and you could spend 7 hours watching everything that came out of Hong Kong. There's another theater down 42nd Street on the same side of the street. I think it's the Madame Tussauds Museum today, but it was called... it was called Live Sex Act. And I never went in there because I didn't want to be that close to a live sex act. But all those guys, all those hustlers, if you watch, you know, the very opening scene, if you watch the opening scene of Basket Case, you'll see 42nd Street as
it's
it looked at that time. Mm-hmm. And if you remember, there's a dope dealer that comes up to... Dwayne, as he's walking down the street, and does this great poetic rant where he names every drug in the history of the world, you know, in rapid fire. And then when Dwayne doesn't seem to want any drugs, he starts in on sex things. You know? And that was, those guys really did exist. They really came up to you on the street in 42nd Street.
I had one of those as late as, I think it was like the end of the 90s, like when I was like, I don't know. I remember being like 14 and some guy trying to give me something special upstairs.
But then video surveillance came in. So now they have they have to sort of semi hide and they go smoke.
Offered. It's just much more subtle, and it's kind of drifted more downtown than it is on Times
Square
now.
My favorite guy for years, for maybe 10 years, he would say smoke, and then the last time I went by, he works in Washington Square Park. Last time I went by, he goes, Echo Tours. I'm like, wait a minute, what are you selling? He said, I'm selling these Echo Tours. You know, they bus you to the Delaware River, and you raft all day, and then they bring you back. And I'm like, what, how did you go from smoke to Echo Tours? And then he says, you know, Trump ruins everything. I don't know what he meant, but you know, that's what he said.
That brings it back to everything is exploitation.
Everything.
That guy just found his thing he has to exploit now. I just want to quickly go back to like when you're seeing the Corman type movies. What was the quality? Like you're talking about kind of being sick of the mainstream Hollywood film. So what was it about these movies? Are you someone who, if there's like one or two great scenes in something, that's good, that's enough to make you go, hey, that's worthwhile? Like, what was it about those films that was speaking to you at that point?
Well, it's there's no such thing as the only sin of a movie, in my opinion, is to be boring. Mm-hmm. Now,
exactly.
We were just saying that earlier today.
Yeah. I would add one other thing that irritates me, but it doesn't eliminate a film from consideration, and that is when the people making the film obviously feel superior to their subject matter. I mean, that's usually a bunch of entrepreneurs who get together and say, let's make one of these stupid horror films and make a bunch of money. And you can always tell. You can always tell by the tone, by the dialogue, that this is somebody who doesn't even like horror who's making a horror film. And you would occasionally get those, and those are the ones that would get one star, you know, because they would always have a certain... they would hire people that would deliver a certain amount of quality in the film. But I hate that superior to the genre kind of attitude.
It's still very prevalent. I've heard it called low-hanging fruit in more than one meeting, and it always it kills me inside.
And the other thing that I don't like, and people have said this on my show, is why did you make this movie? And they say, because horror is a good way to break into the business. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's the only reason you made the movie, because if that's the only reason you made the movie, then, you know, my respect for you just dropped, you know, 50%. But a remarkable number of directors say that. Now, there are many directors who make a great horror movie and then never make another horror movie, and you have to assume that that's why they made the first horror movie. And in their later career, they'll be saying, but it wasn't really a horror movie. It had these other elements. It was a thriller, and it had a subtext. You know, they'll like start completely denying.
It was a social thriller, Get Out.
That's right.
Remember, social thriller.
Social thriller.
Not a horror film. Well, I mean, that's why the cool directors like Sam Raimi, who went that way, then he comes back with a Drag Me to Hell because he wants to.
Yeah.
And you
yeah.
feel it. Peter Jackson needs to do that. There's a director who needs a horror film.
Yeah.
Like, he needs that medicine.
I think it's specifically with horror, it's got to be a genre you love or you're going to suck at it.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. I completely agree. Do you guys want to get into the weird stuff?
The weird.
Let's do some weird here, guys.
This was our homework. We had to pick weird titles.
The weirdest. Well, I went weirdest things I've ever seen. You guys just picked weird titles.
I just want weird.
Just weird. Okay.
Okay, weirdest thing I've ever seen?
Weirdest thing you've ever seen.
Weird cinema. We just picked a bunch.
Have you seen the Belgian pig fucking movie?
Is that the title of it?
Can you say fucking?
Of course you can say fucking.
Can I say what the fuck?
You can definitely say what the fuck. Is the title the Belgian pig fucking movie?
No, I don't remember the title because it's in French. It's either in French or that other language that they talk in Belgium.
Is this
Calvary? No, it's not German. It's like Flemish. Oh. Flemish. There's the Flems and the Belgians and the French. And the Walloons in
Belgium.
So we don't know. But there's one great. Can I digress from
of course
from
you what's may. Already Please. Digression?
There's a great Belgian horror movie. You know what it is? You got to know what it is.
Well, I can name a couple. So what's this?
Daughters of Darkness.
Daughters of Darkness.
Oh, okay.
Daughters of Darkness. I love Daughters
That's
of
the
Darkness.
One.
And it's Flemish. Okay, and the guy that made it, as far as I know, never made another decent movie, and there was no horror renaissance in, what do you call Flemland? Flanders. There was no horror renaissance in Flanders, you know. So in Ostend and Bruges and whatever the other Flemish towns were, you know, they had this wonderful opportunity, you know, because they had this sort of iconic horror film,
mm-hmm. the
and then
hotel.
They fuck everything up in Europe. Yeah. You know, it's like, they get one film, and then there's no legacy to that film. So, anyway, this movie came out in, I would say, I don't know, early 80s, and it's about bestiality with pigs, and, you know, on a farm. And it played in art houses.
Wow.
And that was probably the most difficult film to watch I'd ever.
That sounds intense.
Did you review it with your, like, one word icons or not?
I don't think I ever actually reviewed it. I think I just saw it. We were talking about it, you know.
This is just a throwback to, and some of you will wonder, what is aardvarking exactly? Because in one of your reviews, you'd often use aardvarking. Is that just the sex act?
You've had a very sheltered existence.
has anyone aardvarked here?
I don't know what aardvarking is.
Always obvious from the context of what I'm talking
about.
What aardvarking is.
Is that happening in this pig movie or not?
There were certain things. One thing that makes you creative when you're working for a family newspaper is there's certain things you can't say. Okay.
Okay.
And so what you try to do is you try to make whatever you do say sound dirtier than the Than something real.
Man.
And in fact, when I was at TNT, TNT had an extremely strict standards and practices mm-hmm. department. And so they had a list of words that you couldn't say, and they had a list of topics, you know, you're supposed to avoid. You couldn't smoke. I smoked on the Movie Channel show. You couldn't drink beer. You know, I drank beer on the Movie Channel show. I would invent nonsense words to go in place of the word I wanted to say. Yeah. And then 2 months later, the nonsense word shows up on the official list, you know.
Oh,
and
weird.
So, I mean, the one I remember is, I started calling somebody in the movies slopeheads. And they put it on the list because they said it's an Asian slur. And I said, no, slant eye is the Asian slur. I don't think slope head is the Asian slur. It's slant eye. You know, I didn't say slant eye. I said slope head because, you know, he's like creating. Your head is weird. So, you know, and so they constantly crack down on the stuff. But what I discovered is that often, you know, the made up word becomes funnier than the real word. Mm-hmm. And so, that's how aardvarking happened.
So it wasn't specific. It didn't come from seeing the act with aardvarks or anything weird.
No, there's real aardvarking in the movie. If you I didn't falsify an aardvark count.
Okay, good. We got that.
Oh, you found it.
Yep. Look,
somebody found the Belgian pig fucking movie. Oh, it is called the pig fucking movie.
It is called the pig fucking movie.
It's
oh my
called
God.
Vase de Noces. Vase de Noces. Is that Flemish, French, or something else?
I don't know, but it's in my
car. Or Walloon? Is it Wallonian? Wallonian?
We'll get Vase some tweets de about Noces.
Us. Yeah.
Everybody, all your listeners are going to be.
Going to look that one
tonight.
Up.
They're going to be checking those streaming statistics.
This is going to be trending.
Fucking
did you ever see that one,
spiked.
La Betty, the Beast, that has the big horse sex scene with the weird monster thing?
This just got really weird here, guys.
Wait, actually, we're taking it to a negative turn. All right. Animal cruelty. Becca, what'd you get?
Okay, so I'm going to go in a completely different direction. I'm going to go to...
that was inevitable.
I know. Well, I mean, I could have... Saitan, I was thinking about putting on my list, it does have some animal moments in it,
right.
But it did not quite make my list. That was French? What is Saitan?
I actually think that was Belgium.
Belgium. Calvary was it Belgium? Calvary was
Belgium.
Maybe it's
a Belgium thing. We're on
Belgians are kind of French rednecks.
You know what?
Aren't
I'm going 19.
Oh, I love French.
I'm going 1974 Blaxploitations. Let's
okay.
go there. So this one I saw in college, and I had no idea what I saw, and I thought it was like a fever dream. That I saw, and then it wasn't until years later that I actually discovered it's a thing called Space is the Place, and it was written by this guy named Sun Ra, or Sun Ray, I'm not sure which way to say it. Sun Ra, okay. So in college, I got a bootleg copy of Space is the Place, which is a blaxploitation science fiction film that clearly has a lot of social messaging in it, but it's also soundtracked with this acid rock written by Sun Ra, and it's essentially about a guy who is trying to get to, he's traveling through outer space and he gets blasted through time back into 1930 Chicago, but NASA's trying to assassinate him, and it may be the most batshit crazy thing I've ever seen. Half the characters wear mirrors over their faces, and I have no idea what that symbolizes, but it is just wild, and for some reason it has never entered the normal blaxploitation lexicon of films with like Sugar Hill and all of the other kind of standard ones. The Petey Wheatstraw of the world, the Blackulas, but it needs to because it's an amazing film and it's a really important part of blaxploitation filmmaking.
I'm not aware of that one. Is it an all-black cast?
Yes.
All blacks in space?
Well,
are they in space?
Part of it's in space. And then they come back to 1930s or 40s Chicago. Yeah. It's back in time to Chicago.
Time travel.
Yeah, it's time traveling as well. And then NASA's in it for some reason. They're trying to assassinate him. So it is just crazy. And the soundtrack is crazy. And there's a record. They put it out on a record and it's been re-released recently.
Sounds
the soundtrack
like way
has.
Too much plot getting in the way of the story.
Oh my God. It is so much plot. I have no idea what's going on. But the whole thing, it's just psychedelic and the costumes are crazy. But the whole thing, it feels like it was shot in somebody's backyard, and it probably was. So,
what year is it?
1974.
So at the tail end of the black exploitation
yes. and
craze.
It's got an incredibly long title, but the short one is Space is the Place. It's like Space is the Place or The Journey of, and then it goes on for like five sentences. But Space is the Place is the short version. So yeah, someone on Twitter, I'm sure, will tell me more about it. But it's a hard one to track down, but it was just fucking nuts. So.
What about you,
Ro? Wow. Okay, how do I follow that up? so actually, Shout Factory has done an incredible job putting out a lot of obscure Roger Corman movies. They did a whole line of Corman stuff. I actually worked on a lot of the Blu-rays for things like Galaxy of Terror and stuff like that. But anyway, so they had a sale not too long ago, and because I'm compulsive, I was like, well, I'm missing these five titles that I've never seen before. So I literally bought every Roger Corman title that Shout Factory's put out. The one that I watched right right before we flew out here is from 1982 called Time Walker, and it's directed by Tom Kennedy. And I kind of wish this wasn't on the front and back of the box because it's mild spoiler, sorry, but it's from 1982, so fuck it. There's an alien on the front looking up longingly to the sky, and on the back there's a very strange looking alien on the back, and I'm like, oh cool, it's an alien movie. It sort of is. It's actually, they find a mummy. This is like in the 80s, and some university finds a mummy in King Tut's tomb. But I love it because you hear the earthquake, but you don't see it. They just like show shaking, and they're like, oh, okay, we'll save money by not showing it. And they bring this mummy back to the university where they do an x-ray on it. And I guess the kid that works as like an assistant to this archaeologist or whatever happens to see in the x-ray these little round crystals. And so I don't know why this plan is, but he's like, ooh, I got to take those. And so he goes and he finds them in a hidden compartment in the sarcophagus, steals the crystals, redoes the x-ray, and then starts trying to pawn the crystals all over town. And when antique dealers won't take it, he starts just selling it to his other college buddies to give to their girlfriends. The mummy awakens because it senses that its crystals are missing. And basically, it's a mummy movie on a college campus. And it's really bizarre. And of course, I'm sorry, the twist is that it's not a mummy, it's an alien. And it needs all the crystals back to get back home. And to me, the most, the thing that made me stand up was the ending. I'm not going to tell you the specifics of the ending, but the movie ends in a weird way where then all of a sudden it says, to be continued. It was 1982. Wow. This story has not continued. So I was like, what?
Can we write it here?
What's
it
live?
We're doing it live.
What happened to the alien mummy? I want to know.
Man, I'm sorry.
So Time Walker, I'd never even heard of this. I literally just blind bought it because it was part of, it has no Corman quality to it other than it's cheap. So I have no idea why or how he produced this thing, but he did. And
all right,
it's a
Matt
good
Mercer challenge. You're going to make the sequel to this in 4
Time
days.
Time Walker,
you have
go.
4 days to make the sequel.
Mike
and it will premiere here.
Time Walker 2. On it now.
Please. Time Walker 2,
somebody.
Go.
You're saying nothing happens to the mummy alien at all?
Nothing happens to him? Well, he goes around, he kind of like, oh, so when he takes the crystal, because basically, these are the worst college students of all time. So they buy these like crystals and they make them into necklaces. And so when the mummy takes them back, it leaves a burn on the victim and then it basically eats them away. So he's kind of killing everybody as he's taking it back. But he's really just a happy alien that wants to go home.
Right. So I remember liking Time Walker a lot. I don't remember how it ends. So
It says to be continued. Maybe
it, and that so is why. That makes, it does not end.
That makes sense that it, does, that it doesn't end.
It doesn't end. I was touched yesterday by your Herschel Gordon Lewis tribute.
Yes.
I met him one time as well, and all the things you were saying, totally true. He seemed like such a great guy. There's another filmmaker who I kind of feel that way about, who any of his films would fit this discussion we're talking about, and that is the entire filmography of William Girdler, which just is just bonkers to bonkers. It's all within like 8 years. I think he made 8 or 9 films within that period. He had a premonition that he was going to die young. And this is something when I was researching about him, he thought he was going to die young, and so he decided I have to make as many films. I have to rip off The Exorcist with Black Abby as quick as I can. But the movie I love, because I love when it's like something bonkers and kind of a more mainstream or bigger movie. The movie, when I was like looking at all these things over the last couple of days, when I started thinking about The Manitou, it has got to be one of the weirdest movies ever made. The movie starts, and I only started about 2 years ago, and the movie starts with a woman who's kind of got an ache in her neck, and it turns out, no, that's actually a fetus growing in your neck, and it starts to become this big kind of pussy sack, and she goes to the doctors, and eventually, you know, it becomes a little more logical. You find out it's a 2,000-year-old shaman being reborn.
Totally logic.
Her neck.
Pure logic.
But the cool part is the only thing that can defeat that 2,000-year-old shaman coming out of your neck is Tony Curtis. with a mustache in one scene, but yeah. Who's kind of pretending to be a psychic at the start of the movie, and it's all shot in San Francisco, and it's like kind of a big budget. I mean, for him, it's easily his biggest budget. It was like he was on his way to becoming maybe a studio director. I know when he died, he was in a helicopter looking at locations for a sci-fi epic that he had. So he had gone from these like micro drive-in movies, but this movie, I mean, who here has seen Manitou? It's really kind of spectacular.
Yeah.
And then it goes to a place kind of like Poltergeist 2 by the end with lots of crazy effects, and it's much better, I think, than Poltergeist 2.
Yeah.
But is that one you remember?
I remember I went through a phase of looking at William Girdler's films, yeah. And, the thing that makes them enjoyable, yeah. even though they're bad, is that he apparently was a true believer in those yeah. in those plots. I mean, you can sort of tell that he was really trying to make it believable, yeah. even though they're totally, the writing is so bad that yeah. it's just, you can't.
Yeah, but it makes up for it with like a moment of a great effect or whatever. But I think he's a guy, one of those guys that we talk about, who like they kill themselves on the film mm-hmm. to get it done, to make it, you know,
right.
good,
right.
in quote marks. Anyway, Manitou, highly recommend. It's one of the rare films that will come on like Turner Classic Movies. So it's kind of, I think that's where I saw it the first time. It's like, holy shit, what is that? So that's my pick. What's another weird one that... that doesn't involve pig fucking.
Another weird one? one that we had on my show, and the only reason we had it on TNT is that these guys, these executives at these networks, they go to the Cannes Film Market or the American Film Market or the Milan Film Market or whatever, and they buy these packages of films. Mm-hmm. Now, the package has 40 films in it. They only want three of them. Okay, but they got to buy the other 37. And so they end up with all this crap. And so eventually they call up and say, hey, what would you think if we put this movie on your show? You know, and I always go. I would always say, sure. And so the movie I'm talking about, the movie I'm thinking about, is The Howling 7. The movie,
oh, shit.
The movie that killed the Howling franchise.
Which one is that?
For but about did it?
That is
years.
That is past marsupials,
it,
correct?
It just came back like 2 years ago. But the Howling 7 uses footage from The Howling 4, 5, and 6, nice. But is shot at Pioneertown, California, which is an old B-Western set that was abandoned in the 50s, and all these biker gangs moved in and reoccupied the set and lived there. It was sort of like the Spawn movie ranch or something. And so it became this outlaw town. And so this Australian who had worked on movie crews decides to do his first feature. And he somehow gets the rights to The Howling. And he loves Pioneertown. I think he was living in Pioneertown. He was a biker. And there's one business in Pioneertown, and it's this bar called Pappy's Bar. And Pappy had a very brief country music career and had one hit song that he sings every night at Pappy's Bar. And so they use Pappy's Bar and the little six-room motel and Pioneertown and footage from 4, 5, and 6 and some community theater actors from the area. And it's just the biggest abortion of a film that you've ever seen in your life. But it's a musical.
It oh, has, my gosh, now I'm in.
It has line dancing. It has all these original songs in it. And it's just like this train wreck. You can't stop watching it. And so I'm watching it. I'm saying, you know, this is more fun than Plan 9. Look how popular Plan 9 is. You know, so I'm watching this film, and it's never been on TV, and no one is really aware of it. And I found out from New Line owned it, and I found out later that once he finished shooting, they didn't bother to cut the 35 millimeter film together. So the only copy we had was some pastiche that they'd done that the director had done on video before they were going to do the cut, and then the New Line said, "Don't even bother to cut that thing."
Oh my God!
And so we have this video version. It doesn't even exist in a real version. It's just the video version. And so so I said, "These people in the movie, they're like real people that live there, right? You know." And so we showed the film. I talked about it. I said, "You know, if you were in the movie." You know, write in. Let us know where you are. We might want to talk to you. And so people wrote in a lot about it. People contacted us saying, that was the strangest thing I ever saw. Are you ever going to show that again? And so I said, you know, let's show it again. So the second time we showed it, we got this huge number. It's like word had spread, you know, that this might be the most abominably made but enjoyable film in the history of the world. And so so we kept showing it. And I even went to New Line and I said, do you guys know you have a cult film on your hands? And they just had these vacant expressions on their face. You know, we don't do that kind of stuff. You know, they were like not into like marketing it or, you know, doing a DVD or anything. Because I said, you know, you really ought to release this in a big way because it's working, you know. When Shudder wanted me to do this show, I said, you know, if you really want to show a weird one, I said, can you get Howling 7? And they went and talked to New Line. Apparently, you know, New Line has new ownership now, but apparently they don't know where it is. they don't know where the film is. I think you can only watch it on VHS. I don't think it ever had a DVD release. So, but that was that's probably one of the strange. Also, the Australian director.
Yeah, Felix.
Never seen again. Never seen again. He went back to Australia. So.
Oh wow.
That sounds nuts.
He's also an actor in the film.
So. Wow!
Anyone seen that one here? Just so we
Howling 7.
Wow. Okay, we got a couple.
Oh,
wow.
Two. Okay.
Two.
There's going to be a run on the VHS tape after this episode airs. So get it now.
All right. What's another one?
Let's wait.
Okay. I'm going to go to 1983. Shaw Brothers. Shaw Brothers have done a lot of kind of forays into horror. Like they did their crossovers with Hammer, and they did Corpse Mania, which was kind of more a noir film. But I'm going with Boxer's Omen from 1983, which was also released as Mo. And this one, the plot is a little hard to discern, but a guy is trying to avenge his brother's fight where his brother gets injured, and so he's trying to avenge for his brother, but somehow he gets the scorn of these several black magic wizards, and then the movie kind of just turns into a whole bunch of black magic ceremonies that you watch, but it's a really kind of weird version of magic, and there's a lot of stop animation sequences and really wild and crazy it's literally shot like Suspiria in parts, where it's like this red and blue flashing lights going back and forth, and these little stop animation alligators come across screen. I have no idea what is going on for most of that movie, but it is the most mesmerizing thing ever. The soundtrack is crazy. So anybody, Boxer's Omen. Yeah, it's amazing. So I highly, if you're looking for something weird, there's weird bug action in it, and it's crazy. So.
Like seven people just left because of that.
I know, Boxer's Omen. Like a crowd just left because of Boxer's Omen.
The Endless is beginning, so we can deal with that. It's not our fault.
Yes, it is the Endless
It's not
beginning.
You, Joe Bob.
It's not Shaw Brothers, I hope. So, have you seen Boxer's Omen?
I have not seen it, no.
It is
How
amazing.
How do you spell the second word?
Mo. Omen. O-M-E-N. Okay. And then it was released in...
Boxer's Omen.
Yeah, in some... I think it's on the VHS. It actually says just Mo. M-O. So, M-O. Yeah.
She'll send you a M-O. List after this.
Yes. I've been writing everything
for
down. For follow-up. Yeah.
Let's just keep shooting them out. This is one that I know Elric had talked about on the show previously, and I believe Code Red had put out a Blu-ray of this, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. But I found it on Amazon Prime, and it's called Trick or Treats from 1982.
Not Trick or Treat or Trick or Treat.
No, Trick or Treats. And this was written and directed by Gary Graver. And the lead, it's weird. The lead is Peter Jason, who's in a bunch of John Carpenter movies, including They Live, is probably where you'd recognize him. But it has, the opening scene is gold, where basically he's just sitting outside of his pool, you know, whatever, having coffee, whatever, and his having a conversation with his wife. And then randomly, these two guys from an asylum show up to take him away because his wife has committed him. And so it's this, he's basically fighting for his life, throwing these guys in the pool, whatever, not wanting to be taken away. And so that's kind of how his wife gets rid of him. She just has him committed. And so he gets taken away, and then she remarries David Carradine.
In a top hat,
yeah. Well, so then it cuts, whatever, 7 years later, and she's now remarried to David Carradine. It's Halloween night, so they're both dressed as magicians, I guess.
Yeah.
That's his cameo. And their son is also an aspiring magician. So they bring the babysitter over, who is dating Steve Rails back. But we only see him via phone because he's in the middle of a play. Just a random cast all over the place. And basically the whole movie is kind of the boy that cried wolf, where the little annoying kid keeps playing practical jokes kind of gory jokes on the babysitter. But of course, Peter Jason breaks out of the insane asylum and decides to go back home. So it's a very, you know, Halloween-esque sort of deal. And it may suffer from the immortal sin of boredom in spots, but I just thought it was bonkers. There was all these recognizable faces, and I laughed a lot. So it's not good, but it's entertaining. And you know, Elric and I talked about it on the flight over here, and it's like, it would probably kill with an audience in October. Like, if it was Halloween season and this showed on the big screen in 35, I think a crowd would just have a blast with it. At Home Alone on Amazon Prime, moderately entertaining and fun.
And
so,
the kid's super annoying, right?
No, the kid's very annoying.
He's like, he's Bob level annoying.
Yeah, very much so. So yeah, Trick or Treats from 1982.
Speaking of annoying kids, I'm going to talk about one of my favorite. There's actually a couple films I'm just curious if you're a fan of or not, but this one is just an absolute favorite. I love Canadian exploitation films probably more than anything.
I knew you were going to put this one on your list.
This movie is still the weirdest. I'm kind of obsessed by this movie, and that is The Pit, a.k.a. based on the book Teddy, about a boy and his teddy bear that talks back to him. The original book, I guess, was about like an 8-year-old or something, but in the translation to the screen, they made it like a 12-year-old. Which makes it really dirty, because if it had been a young kid, a lot of things wouldn't feel so dirty. Now it feels like it's one of the most pervy, strange movies.
He feels
movies.
So pervy it's with just that babysitter.
So basically, it's this pervy kid who it opens with him like drawing, cutting out all the nude pictures out of a book out of the library, and then sending it to the librarian and kind of saying, "Hey, how about it?" kind of thing. And his parents are conveniently going away for an extended period of time, so they get him this imported babysitter who's going to look after him. Of course, she's like just his type. So he gets excited. He confides in his teddy bear lot, but this is all after the fact that the opening scene is he takes a kid on Halloween night out into the forest, and there's a giant pit in the middle of the forest where he basically pushes this kid, and we don't know what happens to the kid initially, but you, as the film progresses, you find out there's something called trollologs, or trollalas as he calls them, which are just like basically goblin creatures like Morlocks or something who live in this pit. And you're not really, I guess in the book, the idea is that you're not sure if this is just a psychological defect of this child's mind that he talks to his teddy and that there's not really something in the pit. But in the movie version, they basically push everything all the way, which is like, nope, there are really these weird hobgoblins in a pit eating humans that he starts feeding all the people who wrong him in the town. And then his creepy relationship with the babysitter just gets worse and worse as he's watching her have showers and stuff. And there is a scene where where he's not there, where Teddy looks at us, the audience, and like the head turns and the eyes glow, and we're like, okay, so this is no longer in this kid's mind. This is like one of those movies that if you haven't discovered it, I hope you'll be thanking me. I think Rob was mad at me. A couple people were mad at me about this one.
I love this one.
Up and some people watch and just go, oh my God, that was
somebody
insufferable.
Somebody in the audience, Sarah, was that it? She told me beforehand that she owns it on VHS.
Oh, yes.
So, yeah.
If anyone
Blu-ray,
owns the book,
Blu-ray.
I'm
she
dying
has the Blu-ray.
To read the book, but it's $300 on eBay.
Yes.
So I've never been able to read the Teddy book, but I don't know if you saw that one. I mean, Canadian exploitation must have been on your radar.
I did see that. You know, the Canadians have a lot of time on their hands because they're waiting for summer, which is August 7th to August 10th. And so they have genres up there that you don't find anywhere else, you know. Have you ever heard of maple syrup porn? Maple syrup porn was a type of movie that was only made in Quebec in French from about 1968 to 1971. The first movie was called Valerie, and it was always about Catholic convent girls who would be liberated, and they would become strippers and prostitutes and be used by men until they settled down as good Catholic housewives. Oh, wow. and it was only shown in Quebec, and it's only known to the Quebecois, or, you know, so. But you gave me an idea of what was weird in the 80s. My bosses at Showtime Networks would buy all this softcore porn from Europe, and each country had its distinctive type of softcore porn, like British porn, like Adventures of a Plumber's Mate. That would be a British porn.
Working class.
And the whole point of the movie would be to get to the scene where a naked male is running down the street, you know, or something. That would be, that's just hysterical to the Brits. It's hysterical for naked men to be running down the street, you know.
So many
and, And the Italian porn was always pedophilia. I mean, it was always guys lusting after the Catholic schoolgirls and trying to get in their pants. And then Spanish porn was always wild parties at the resort. So there was one called Wild in Ibiza, you know, Ibiza being an island off the coast of Spain, and it would just be nonstop. It would be like an extended spring break movie with just sex scene after sex scene. And then, but the weirdest one of all, and this is what I was getting to, was the West German sex comedy. Now, there was no such thing as an East German sex comedy. I don't know why they said West German sex comedy, you know, because the Berlin Wall was still up, you know. And they were mostly, they were all bad. They were all horrible. They were all hard to watch. But there was one that no matter how many times we showed it, it would always get this huge rating. And it was called She's 19 and Ready. Oh. And she wasn't 19, she was 45. And she wasn't ready, and you didn't really want her to be ready. But I don't know how many times I would like look at the lineup and they would say, oh no, we're showing fucking She's 19 and Ready again. And they said, yeah, well, I mean, we've discovered, like, in the 11:30 p.m. time slot on Friday night, you know, well, we get a number on that. And it was like, it was just these, the Germans, as opposed to the Brits or the Spanish, were creepy. Creepy, creepy about sex. You know, you would like, boy, I hope I never have sex with a German because, you know, it could be anything. It could make anything into a sexual situation. And actually, a guy wrote into me who had written the ultimate book on sex in Thailand. Some guy who had like studied the sex in Thailand, and he said, you know, the only nationality that the Thai hookers won't have sex with is the Germans. And I said, well, that makes sense. Have you seen the West German sex comedy? You know,
and well, even their dramas, like The Night Porter, is like, yeah, super creepy. Yeah.
And so these softcore porn things that were made in the 80s were one of the weirdest, most expendable genres ever, you know. And I doubt if any of them are watched at all today, you know. But anyway, that's a weird one. Did anybody see She's 19 and Ready? You wouldn't admit it if you had seen it.
If we're screening it right now, they would all stay. I can tell.
Well, oddly enough, I have a Japanese-German co-produced softcore porn on my list.
Of course they do.
So I'm going to jump in with Underwater Love from 2011. Has anyone seen this? I saw it at the Tribeca. Good. I'm glad.
There is some.
It's weird, right? It's really fucking weird. I saw this at the Tribeca Film Festival.
The guy in the Deadly Prey shirt song, of course.
So this played at the Tribeca Film Festival in 2011. And it's one of these films that I'm still like, I can't believe I saw this at the Tribeca Film Festival. It's Underwater Love, a pink musical. So it's a musical and it's a porn and it's a fantasy. And it is about this girl who works in a fish factory, and one day she finds a kappa, which is like this mythical Japanese creature, and she falls in love with it. But then she realizes that the kappa is actually this friend of hers that drowned when he was 17, reanimated into a kappa human hybrid humanoid form. And then they fall in love and sing a bunch of songs, and it has sex in it, a lot of sex, that does not look to be simulated, although it's shot like a very well-cut Skinamax movie where you never actually see a lot, but you see a lot. So yeah, it is weird, just weird. So, and it is a German-Japanese co-production.
And that, it says 2011?
2011.
So it's recent.
It's recent.
What's the title again?
Underwater Love, a Pink Musical.
A pink musical.
Yes, it is bizarre as shit. I highly recommend it. And I remember at the time when they premiered it, I remember everyone kept saying, because Birdemic had just come out, and everybody was like, it's going to be the next Birdemic. And it fell. Like, I never heard anything about it, but it's something that I keep. Anytime somebody's like, what's the weirdest thing you've ever seen? I'm like, Underwater Love, by far.
Well, I know you named three countries, but that's Japanese. That's definitely Japanese.
As soon as you hear the word pink, it's Japanese immediately. And it definitely kind of leans towards that. But it, like, when I looked it up, I was like, oh, it, like, the producers and a lot of the money was out of Germany. So as soon as you mentioned German softcore, I was like, oh, I'm here. I got this. So, Underwater Love.
Wow. If we're talking weird, we can't not talk about the great Frank Henenlotter.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I know Joe Bob is a big advocate of the original Basket Case, and I love all his movies, but I'm actually going to, I've said this before on the show, this is one of my favorite sequels of all time because it's so weird, but I love Basket Case 2 from 1990. It actually has my favorite ending to a sequel ever. And it's just because, I mean, if you hear, I mean, Henenlotter is the first to tell the story, and I'm going to paraphrase, but basically he went into pitch some, from what I understand, he wanted to pitch some ideas at Glickenhaus. They didn't like any of his ideas at all. And so on the spot, he came up with Frankenhooker. We can do a version of Frankenstein with a Frankenhooker. And they're like, great, what else you got? And he's like, and I guess we could do a sequel to Basket Case. So neither Frankenhooker nor Basket Case 2 were like these stories he was burning to tell. They came out of an abrupt meeting, and they're two of my favorite movies of all time. But Basket Case 2, I mean, obviously not everything was said in Basket Case 1, so we needed more to that story. But no, I just like it because it's weird. Basically, these the brothers, Dwayne and Belial, Belial is a little, they were essentially Siamese twins that didn't fully form. They were separated by doctors. And so the first movie is them getting revenge on all the doctors that separated them. Whereas the second one is they kind of get whisked away to, I don't know if it's like a commune or just a house, but basically it's a house with other similar deformed monsters, if you will. I don't want to call them monsters. Somewhere. Freaks. Yes, like very much freaks.
But freaks is okay.
Monsters, but they don't look anything like it's, this is like beyond deformities. It's like, this is, if you're on acid, what they might look like at one of these things. And just, I just love the imagination behind it, how crazy it is and how many different characters there are. And in particular, I think Dwayne's, Kevin, what's his last name?
Van Hintenrick.
Yes.
I can never say it right. Yeah. Thank you. I think he's great in it. The one thing that I know, for whatever reason, they all regret, and it always creeped me out, is he does have one shot where he's the face of Belial. Yeah. And I always kind of wish that they would do another one where he's just, like, he's Belial as well as Dwayne. He's courting a girl that lives there that he assumes is normal, and she's got the biggest secret of all. And again, the way that they kind of conclude the movie is one of my favorite endings to a sequel ever. So I love Basket Case 2. Basket Case 3, not so much.
Yeah.
And Frank would be the first to admit that he probably should have stopped at 2. But by the way, there's a new incredible Blu-ray release from Arrow, which I believe Joe Bob is on. I think they did a feature of you talking about.
Oh, yeah. We're talking about the release of Basket Case.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that feature's on there. But they also, Frank shot a new thing called Basket Case 3.5. And it's basically, he plays a documentarian that's going to interview Dwayne about his brother Belial. So it's a little 15-minute short that acts as a sequel to the last one. And it's just a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. So
you'll be happy to know that Kevin Van Hintenrick is writing Basket Case 4 on spec because he feels like he hasn't fully explored.
There's a lot to be said in Basket Case.
Yeah, so Kevin is, Kevin is a sculptor, by the way.
Yeah.
He's like a very well-paid, massive monumental sculptures in stone, including the Rip Van Winkle, the giant Rip Van Winkle that's on the top of Hunter Mountain, wherever Hunter Mountain is. That's Kevin Van Hintenrick's day job.
Love it.
But he wants to come back. He wants to do another one.
I think we need one more Basket Case movie, or just another Frank movie.
As long as Frank does
Frank
it,
would be game, I'm sure.
I had a couple I wanted to ask you, because I've never heard you talk about. There's a movie I like called Possession.
Oh, my God.
It has Sam Neill. It's not my pick, but it is the weirdest movie I've ever seen. But did you ever see that film, Sam Neill, Isabella Gianni? kind of wild, your Eastern European film?
I don't think so, but describe it and maybe I'll remember it.
He's going to send you a copy now.
Can I describe that? No, I want to watch it with you now. That's like my new dream. Watching that film with you, and you can interrupt as much as you want.
See, people always assume I'm more of an authority than I am. The true authorities on exploitation films are people who never leave their apartment.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
I've met them all at conventions and things, and they have titles that none of us have seen.
All right, well, I'll just pester you until we get that on the books. Okay. But that is about as weird as I've seen. There's somebody like that I love from like Extra. It's just so hard to narrow it down, but I'm going to talk about one that I've talked about a lot, but I think it's the strangest, might be the strangest I've ever seen is, Society, man. Like, it's wrapped up as a high school teen flick, but where it goes, in terms of the last 20 minutes of a movie, did you see Brian Yuzna's Society?
Yeah.
You know, you're watching a giant shunt, but which is one thing if it was like filmed in a realistic nudist kind of way, but instead you have like some of the best effects you've ever seen in a movie, and they're so grotesque and goopy, and one person's pulled inside out, people's bodies are conjoining, a woman are backwards in terms of sexuality. It's one of the craziest things, and I started at such a young age, but I really since then haven't seen something stranger than that, especially something that feels big. Again, it had a budget to deliver those effects, and when you have a budget to do these kind of effects. Like we had Jim Wynorski on our show once, and he talked about the time he made the film where a man is going to be turned inside out. From Corman. He had to recut a trailer. And of course, they couldn't actually do it, so the movie wasn't good. But in this, they actually do those things. And I don't know. This is one of those movies that just, I talk about it a lot now, but because people can actually see it because it's on Blu-ray. But it is wild. It's like Gwilliam, actually. I think Gwilliam would be perfectly at home in that orgy.
But it was... We had Brian Yuzna on the show just a couple of weeks ago, and listening to him describe it, like he describes it like he's just describing a romantic comedy that he made. Like it's just the most casual thing in the world for him.
It's probably like operating Jabba the Hutt when you watch those old like things and you see all the people inside the animatronics, and they're just, it looks kind of Jabba-ish too. I don't know.
Yeah, it actually does.
It's kind of kinky Jabba. Anyway, did you like that one? Were you a fan of Society? Or
you guys never leave your apartments, do you?
No, we don't. Once in a while, we come to a show, and that's about it.
So what are your thoughts on Society from your memory?
I always insist on some kind of third act payoff.
The shunt wasn't
a shunt.
That's part of the story.
Was it too Western Germany for you?
Yeah. No, I like Brian Yuzna is a great producer.
Stuart Gordon enjoyed that.
I know.
Should we do one more? What's one more? You got one more weird title?
Oh, well.
From the
depths. Come up with another one?
So, yeah, one more crazy film to lay down.
Bad or just weird?
Just weird. Crazy.
Something that you like, maybe.
Yeah.
I remember this totally... It's like I never thought there was such a thing as a totally plotless movie. A movie that has absolutely no plot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Super Beast. Now, we used to show this movie because it had the title Super Beast.
Yeah.
Therefore, people wanted to see it. But there is no beast. Nothing is super. It's just like an hour and a half of
some
people wandering around the jungles of the Philippines. And in fact, I had a contest that I said... anybody that can successfully describe the plot of this movie, I will send you a case of Old Milwaukee. And then I got in trouble because you're not supposed to, offer free gift alcohol on TV. But we got like 200, like extensive synopses of the movie. And I said, nope, no winners, sorry. It doesn't begin to describe how plotless this movie is. It's just like, I don't know if it was perhaps it was shot in Spanish or Tagalog, and then the dubbing, didn't make sense when they tried to sync it up or what. But it was just totally incomprehensible. Now, I know when I go places and say something's totally incomprehensible, everyone watches it that night. So if you have a chance to watch Super Beast, don't. you will not be rewarded with some kind of great cult movie experience. You know.
I think we're going to watch that one.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a commentary track.
We will drink Old Milwaukee.
And all right, watch one Super more Beast. One more. You know what? I'm going to go with this one just because there was news about it. So I've talked about the Freeway series on the show before and about how much I fucking love the Freeway series. And then a couple of weeks ago, they announced that they were releasing Freeway 1 and 2 on Blu-ray. And somebody messaged me and was like, you did this, Becca. And you know what? I'm going to take full fucking credit for it. So Freeway 1 and Freeway 2. But the craziest one by far. Freeway 1, it's batshit crazy. But it's actually like a really good movie as well. Freeway 2 is just a hot mess of brilliance is the only way I can describe it. It's just a lot of crazy brilliance. So it is about a reform school, I'll call it, for girls, but they're all very bulimic and they break out. Two of them break out. One of them is a serial killer. They end up at a house, they kill some people, and then somehow Vincent Gallo in nun drag gets involved, and there's pornography and a child exploitation ring and a lot of drug use, and it ends up in Mexico, and it is just crazy. And John Landis is in it. So Freeway 2, Confessions of a Trick Baby, which apparently is coming to Blu-ray soon. Previously, the only way you have been able to see it is on VHS, which I have held near and dear to my heart. And somebody who I think is in the audience actually brought me a burned Blu-ray of it, so I at least had something nice to watch until the schnazzy one comes out in a year or two. Freeway 2, Confessions of a Trick Baby. And I will also say that I think that a lot of my love of weird movies goes back to 1985's Return to Oz, which was like one of my favorite films of my youth, and I still go back and watch it. That's, and I'm like, movie, I don't know what the fuck is going
is that
on.
Walter Murch?
It's Walter Murch, directed and wrote it. He is the guy who edited. He won Academy Awards for editing editing. Apocalypse Now and a whole bunch of stuff. Yeah, really famous sound editor. Wrote it, and if you actually like read a bunch of the Oz books, like the Legend of Ozma and things like that, a lot of the original Oz books, you can see kind of where it comes from. But then he puts it in an insane asylum and tries to electrocute people, and there's drownings and beheadings, and the Wheelers, what the fuck are they? And it just gets crazy. And so that one would definitely be on my weirdest films list ever. And I'll also do a quick throw out to Sion Sano, just because I know both Elric and I absolutely love him, and I recommended Tag on the show a couple of weeks ago, and I've enjoyed the tweets from people who have made it 20 minutes in and then gone, holy shit, I wasn't expecting that. It's just such a fun film. See Tag. It's on Netflix now. You will not see it coming. But like, start watching it and just force yourself to keep going for 20 minutes, and then it gets amazing. Has anybody in the house seen Tag? Two people, that's it? Is it not crazy? It's fucking crazy. Watch Tag on Netflix. Okay.
What else? Oh, hi, I'm back.
How
sorry.
Was the bathroom?
I'm sorry, guys. You could call it that. I've been consuming coffee and beer all day, so I just couldn't hold it anymore. I'll do one last one, and then I do have a question before we wrap up with Joe Bob. But and it was inspired by your presentation last night, through Herschel Gordon Lewis stuff. Nobody really talks about this anymore, but a filmmaker named Jeremy Kasdan remade The Wizard of Gore in 2007. And to me, it's the type of remake, it's what a remake should be, which is kind of taking the spirit and the basic elements of the original and then doing your own take on it. I think his version of Wizard of Gore is weird, but really, really cool. And basically, all star cast. Who else are you going to put in that role as the Wizard of Gore other than Crispin Glover? Yeah. Who, again, I'm not sure if he's acting or not. I'm fairly certain he's on stage actually performing these gory tasks and then immediately asking the audience, did you feel that?
Yeah.
Did you feel anything?
Such a good montage.
Yeah. So you're like, wow, that's pretty cool. But Kit Pardue is the lead of it. Bijou Phillips is in it as well. Jeffrey Combs is unrecognizable. He's wearing a lot of prosthetics and has kind of got an element in it, but super cool movie and just one that not a lot of people talk about. And it's interesting because Herschel, you would think that more people would have remade a lot of his films, and really there's only that in 2001 Maniacs. I'm surprised not more people have remade Herschel stories, because there's regardless of how he felt about the films, there is always a kernel of an idea in there that is interesting, that could use a good update. So I really love the Wizard of Gore remake, and if you haven't seen it, I think it's worth kind of checking out.
I agree. And I think that somewhere there is a brilliant Color Me Blood Red remake. Somewhere. It's going to happen.
There's quite a few that have blood. Yeah.
The only way you can remake one of Herschel's films is just regard the film as the one-line idea for a film. And then write a film.
Right.
Because there was not much. I mean, talk about linear plots. Talk about no subtext. Yeah. Talk about characters who mean exactly what they're saying. Talk about no suspense. I mean, it's like, you know, talk about a guy who never bothered with a close-up. Mm-hmm. you got a lot of problems trying to remake you have to love some specific quirky aspect of the story, not the film itself.
Mm-hmm. So. Right.
Yeah, but I think that was one of the things that the Wizard of Gore remake did really well, is that it kind of transcends the original. Because the original, even though it's still fun to watch, it very much functions like a Grand Guignol thing, where it's just like, and now we're going to watch somebody get their eyes gouged out, and now we're going to pull this woman's tongue out. And the remake still has that, but it definitely pushes past that, and it gets really interesting and goes to different places.
Well, you have a solid opening. Mm-hmm. Like, if your opening five-minute scene is great, and for that one, it actually introduced me to one of my favorite bands, because it's a sequence cut to the Black Heart Procession, a piece of music from them. Basically, the lead character kind of putting, I guess it's bloody skin or something, through the presses for a newspaper. And you're just like, what the hell am I watching? Like, it already has almost a classy opening. And so from that, I'm in. And then, of course, the cast is like, I think Jeremy cast it with all like Suicide Girls. So there's that gimmick to it as well, on top of Crispin Glover. I mean, how much more weirder can you get than those elements? So I think it's cool. I think just more people should try to rediscover that one.
Mm-hmm. The equivalent of Herschel today would be Fringe short films. Because, there was a place that you could make a film that bad in the days of Herschel Gordon Lewis, and the sub-distributor system would take it over, and you would never have to be in a legitimate theater, but you could still get a release, you know. And so that role today is a super weird short film. So there are people all over the world who don't have smartphones, they have dumb phones. They're in countries where, you remember when you could first watch video, but it was really slow and it was most people in the world have phones like that, okay? So there's an intense demand for short subjects, and short subjects that are entertaining, that can be watched on those phones, dumb phones. And so there's a distribution system for extremely interesting short subjects, you know. Mm-hmm. And so if Herschel was around today, he would be making those films and selling them to Pakistan like crazy.
The last one is actually kind of like taking a Herschel Gordon Lewis. It would be his Herschel Gordon Lewis film. It's a film, it feels like the embodiment, like if somebody could film what a migraine feels like, that's what this movie is. It's Cat in the Brain by Lucio Fulci.
Oh, yeah.
It's actually a painful experience, and I love Fulci. He's one of my favorite directors. This isn't one of my favorite of his films.
It's the hat, isn't it? It's the hat.
So he basically, I don't know where this idea came from for an Italian but his idea was to dress like Elmer Fudd. Mm-hmm. So take Elmer Fudd, put him in therapy, and that's the whole genesis of this movie. And so it's like, what's interesting is like Fulci's a guy, you watch his other movies, you're like, oh, I wonder what's going through his head. And like, that's what this movie is. This is like his confessional of all I think about it, or maybe it's satirical. I think it is, but it's such a strange film, as we just see like murder after murder, and it's just murder set pieces, very much like a Herschel Gordon Lewis film. And Lucio just walking around with his Elmer Fudd jacket being weird and talking to a psychiatrist, having no idea who the killer is in the film, that's kind of stalking the storyline. And it has a soundtrack that is like Metal Gear shifting in your head. It's painful. That's what I mean. It kind of feels like a migraine. So, and I feel like it's purposeful. I feel like it's him trying to create this awful experience for you. Super weird movie. I haven't sold anyone on watching it, that's for sure. I think I just did the opposite, but it does feel like his Gordon Lewis film, and it's one I don't understand at all, but I'm glad he made it. Yes. I'm glad Fulci's out there.
Soundtrack's great.
Fulci lives.
Soundtrack is, even though you refer to it as Metal Gears. There's a wonderful vinyl version release that is actually quite nice.
Yeah, but he's just like, it's always, I think that could be a whole show on itself, is like when directors who aren't actors decide to star in a film. Kind of like The Endless.
The Endless playing right next door right now.
They do a better job than Lucio does. But it is a weird, it's a weird thing to do because you have to assume that if it wasn't for money reasons, then it's because like Dario kills people with his hands because he always says, oh, because my hands will do it the best. So it has to be some place of ego, like I can do this better than any actor could, which is already wrong.
But it's all voiceover too, which is weird. Like there's scenes of him just sitting in a cafe just drinking coffee and then you're hearing, I was thinking of a woman dying 2 days ago. And it's just such a strange melange.
But I love getting to watch him dressed like that. It's just so funny. Like, and I also love when Italian movies are trying to pretend like their movies are in America and there's, you know, flags everywhere and California flags and just everything you can throw at the screen to trick someone. It's great. Is that your favorite movie?
One of the no, I do like all these Italian movies that we're talking about, but partly because those guys that were hanging around Rome together, they all knew each other in the 70s and early 80s. They didn't really care about plot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All they cared about was images, you know, shocking images. And there was only one guy, the forgotten guy of the, all those guys. I think his first name is Dante Sacchetti. Mm. Because once they would get these weird images, they would go get Dante because he was the only writer. He was the only guy who could write these stories. And they would give him these stupid image ideas, and then Sacchetti would put it into some kind of reasonable narrative. So a movie like Demons would be completely unwatchable if it were not for the fact that they went and got Sacchetti to write some kind of like sort of loosely based, you know, connective tissue to make it watchable, you know. And so that sounds like one of those where they didn't have enough Sacchetti working on it. Yeah. You know, and so, and I saw recently where you can go to the University of Florence and take a class from Dante Sacchetti.
Oh, wow.
And I'm thinking, well, that's weird because, you know, because most of the people there are there because, you know, they're studying art and Leonardo da Vinci was there. And, you know, what are you here for? Oh, I'm here for, you know, the guy who wrote Demons. I'm here.
I had one last question. And you know, Joe Bob, thank you so much for all your time for spending this afternoon with us. We really appreciate it. And we've always wanted to have you on the show. I was set up. The two Chrises told me that you had a great story regarding this. But I wanted to ask you about interviewing Linda Blair, because it's somebody that you'd always wanted to talk to, and apparently it took a while for you to actually get a chance to speak with her. So if you could share with us your Linda Blair story, I hope I didn't just set you up.
Well, I don't remember my Linda Blair story. I mean, I remember having Linda on the show. Mm-hmm. Linda was not crazy about talking about The Exorcist. I mean, it was like pulling teeth to try to get her to... She was... Linda Blair is from Connecticut, and she was into... competitive horse jumping and things like that, and she was sort of not into the playful nature of the. Have you had her on this show?
No, not yet.
No,
okay,
not yet.
Well then, you know, she
it'll be all Exorcist 2 on our show.
She was not into the you know, usual joking around that we would do. She was much more interested in being, you know, super serious about. The movie and her career, and especially didn't want to talk about the middle parts of her career.
Savage Streets period, which I love.
I like Witchery. Yeah.
What's that?
Witchery. Even though it was definitely the middle part of her career, but I really like that
Hell
one.
Knight.
Hell Knight.
So,
but no, I had a lot of guests like that on the show who they would go to one extreme or the other. Because we had a no second take rule, and some of the actors we would tell we have a no second take rule, and they would just panic. They would just go crazy. They would just say, "What? You never do a second take?" And I said, "No, no. Once we start, we go." And some I won't embarrass them, but some really accomplished actors would not want to do that, you know. And I would say it's really going to be okay, you know. If it makes you feel better, I'll tell you the questions in advance. Although I didn't really tell them the real questions in advance, because it's no good unless there's a little bit of uncomfortable, you know, moments. You know, you have to like ask them the "Are you still beating your wife?" question. Are the thing will be dead, you know. And so, I always discover the secret. And you guys, this will be advice you can use. See these chairs that you have here. these are way too comfortable. Right. You need really hard, uncomfortable chairs if you're going to interview somebody. Otherwise, they sit back in that chair, they relax, they think that it's some kind of thing where you're just chatting, and eventually you have to scream at them, are you in show business or what? You know, and they won't, you know, because the interview will suck, you know. And so Linda must have been having a bad day or something, because she wasn't really into the humor part of her career.
I had one.
But I don't know what
week.
Story I told Chris. You know, it might have been a better story.
I figured while we're here, just to wrap up, it would be nice to just ask a couple questions, if there's any, just because you guys have us here and you have Joe Bob, it's not the best for the people at home, but
any questions
we're here.
From so, the audience?
A question before we go, because we'll be wrapping up in a second.
Yeah.
Any hands?
Yeah.
One right there.
This is for Joe Bob. Can you explain how you got involved with Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 2?
I'll repeat. Yeah, repeat that question.
The question is for Joe Bob. How did you get involved in Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 2?
I was sent down to Austin by Rolling Stone magazine to interview Dennis Hopper. And Dennis Hopper was just coming out of rehab. Dennis Hopper had been invisible for years. And he had finally licked all his substance abuse problems. And he was back with a William Morris agent. And he was reading scripts. And he says, the first movie I want to do is Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. And his agent said, no, we don't want you to do that. Why do you want to do that? And he said, well, because it's in Austin. I'm friends with Willie Nelson. The Willie Nelson picnic is there. I can hang out with my old buddies. And so for these completely ridiculous reasons, you know, he wanted to go to Austin and be in this movie. So I'm down there. Interviewing Dennis Hopper for an article in Rolling Stone, and somebody tells Toby Hooper, oh, look, it's the guy who, like, championed Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And the guy who wrote Texas Chainsaw 2, the guy who wrote Paris, Texas, Kit Carson. He says, go over there with Kit and write a couple of scenes for yourself. You know, that's how casual it was. And so I talked to Kit, and we wrote this couple of stupid scenes. And then before the movie, and we did the scenes, and then before the movie came out, they were trying to cut the running time. And so a couple of weeks before it came out, Toby calls, very apologetic, and he says, you know, Cannon made me cut the scenes. They said, you know, they didn't need those scenes. And I said, that's so surprising, Toby, that those scenes wouldn't be an organic part of the script. You know, and so the scenes, I think they were restored on one of the DVDs.
Yeah,
I think
they're on the DVD.
That was the whole story on, and then I didn't see Toby for years, and then I did, around the year 2000, I wanted to do the ultimate Texas Chainsaw Massacre story from beginning to end, all the characters, how it affected their lives, everything, and I got commissioned to do that by Texas Monthly Magazine. And so I spent about 3 days with Toby. He was a really difficult interview. He didn't do many interviews. And I spent about 3 days with him and Bob, FX guy that did the effects on Chainsaw. And did this piece that that's the backstory of Chainsaw. Is one of the most interesting backstories of any movie ever made, including the subsequent life of it and the connection to the mafia and the number of people that were destroyed by it, you know, and the number of people whose careers didn't recover from it. And so and then occasionally I would hear from Toby, but he was pretty reclusive. He was pretty reclusive for most of his life. His son would stay in touch with me and tell me what he was doing.
You're directed by Scorsese too, right?
I was in but between the Movie Channel show and the TNT show, I went on auditions, and so one of the auditions was for Casino, and I didn't know what it was, and the casting director said, you know, we want you to come in and read this part, and it's two scenes, and it's with, the scenes are with De Niro, and I said, oh, my fucking God. Because I'm a terrible auditioner. I am terrible. I get too nervous, and it's like, and I don't read well from the, you know, from the side. They give you these little, you know, you're like, it's 30 words, you know. Yeah. Show off for us with these 30 words, you know. And so I'm like calling up all my friends. You got to rehearse with me. I got to do this thing. And then the casting director calls back, and she says, you know what? Marty is going to be in the office that day. I think I'll have you just read for Marty. Instead of reading for me, you can read for Marty. And I'm going, Marty? Yeah, Mr. Scorsese, the director, Marty. And I was like, oh, fuck, you know? And so now I'm going to go in and read this thing, you know, for Scorsese. And then she calls back and she says, you know what? I'm going to have Bobby come in. You're going to read with Bobby. You're going to read with Bobby for Marty. You know, and I'm like, oh, my God, you know. And so I'm, like, kind of scared, and I go in, and in the casting office, they have all these guys with the mafia faces. In the waiting room, all those guys that are in Goodfellas and all those movies, they have those yeah. killer faces, and they're all sitting in there, and they're saying, would you tell Marty that nobody's validating our parking? You know, we all got to go back to Jersey. And so, you know, so I'm waiting with these guys. And then they call me in, and there's Scorsese. And he says, and the first thing he says to me is, he says, what do you think is the best women in prison movie?
That's awesome. Gotta love it.
And what was your answer?
And I said, you know, I said, I don't think many people would agree with me, but I think it's Caged Heat. And he says, you know what? I think you're right.
Nice.
And then he followed it up. He said, and would you agree that the woman in prison, women in prison, is a separate genre? It's not a subgenre of the prison movie. Mm-hmm. And I said, of course you're right, Mr. Scorsese. And so that relaxed me. And then De Niro came in, and he didn't know his lines, and he had to use his glasses to look at the script, and so he wasn't looking at me. He was looking down at the paper. And so I said, oh, okay, you know. And I said, by the way, I have 7 different ways to do this. And so I did it, and I thought, well, that was a good experience, even if I didn't get the part, you know. And so next day they called and said, okay, you're perfect, you know, come on and do it, you know. And by the way, I'm the crux of the whole movie. it's like everything happens because of me in that movie. You know, this whole world falls apart because of me. He fires me, that's it.
You know? Wow.
So true.
Okay, one more.
One more question.
Last question from Ed.
Ed.
This for Shotwave premiere. Have you ever thought over the years of ever doing like a collaboration, like a nonfiction book about your experiences in filmmaking and such?
We've talked about various other incarnations of Shockwaves, but never a book. Not a bad idea, guys.
Writing's hard.
Writing's hard. Yeah.
Podcasting.
If I won the lottery and didn't have to worry about money, I would love to write a book about all the people I've interviewed in my life and the tell-all version of that. Because I've worked on like hundreds of behind-the-scenes features for Blu-rays and stuff. And I have stories that will last all weekend, which we could talk about after this.
Yeah.
But not publicly.
Yeah. I keep saying at some point I'm going to write my Fangoria years as a memoir, the 15 years I spent at Fangoria, because there is so much just wild fucking crazy stories that I would love to tell. And someday when I have time, I will sit down and do so.
I feel like I'm just getting started.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm at the starting point of things I love. So no biographies yet. Let's just keep talking about movies we love.
Now, do you guys normally do this in some swank, funky studio on Melrose Avenue?
No, it's not funky or swank. It is the Blumhouse Executive Room, which does have some really bitchin' posters in it, I will say. And they, like, Mom and Dad have good food, so we hang out there. And, yeah, so.
So just some common conference room.
Yeah, it's a conference room for the most part.
That's exactly correct.
Sounds small.
Yeah. Yeah, it's literally like they take all of the executive meetings on the upcoming Blumhouse features, go see Truth or Dare, during the day, and then we take it over at night and, you know, drink beer and
have a podcast.
I
thought you would be at some kind of like cool downtown hotel, you know, where they serve $20 cocktails.
Oh, that's way too hip for us. Lord, no.
Not that glamorous.
No, no.
It could still be done. anyway, thank you. It's been honestly a pleasure having you.
Honor.
Talking weird
honor.
Movies with the
great to be here.
And thank you guys as a crowd. This is huge for us.
Yes.
So much fun
thank you
seeing
so
your
much.
Smiling faces.
Thanks,
Let's
Chattanooga so cool. Film yep. Festival. Yeah. Thank you, Chris.
Keep it weird.